welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host, Brian Vitale. Joining me, we have Josh Torres.
Hello.
We have Mikhail Mandani.
Hello.
We have Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Galizio.
Hello.
And Chao Minwu.
How's it going?
Chao, you combo breaker. Well, we're back, and thank you for staying up late with us once again, Mikhail. We're recording this on Saturday, April 12th, and I'm looking at our little outline that we've prepared for ourselves, and I'm like, finally, a breather. We've come off two very hectic weeks of back-to-back Nintendo Directs, a new console, like, not announcement, but detailing, tons of releases throughout the months of, really since last, like, what, October through April has just been nonstop. And we finally have a little bit of a breather. Not that we don't have anything to talk about, but I'm looking and I'm like, finally, we have some room to breathe. So this will be a little bit of an interesting podcast in terms of topics to talk about. We, of course, have a lot of games coming up at the end of the month that we have people on site that are working towards that aren't available to talk about yet. Of course, over the last couple months, we've had some more dates kind of crop up for the summer window, the Summer Games Fest sort of time frame, the new E3. We've already talked a little bit about some dates being assigned, and we'll go into this. Microsoft setting their dates about when they're going to have a Direct. We've talked about what Nintendo might talk about at that time frame. Summer Games Fest has its date set. Of course, it has for a while. So we're kind of in that period between the deluge of Q1 2025 launches and the summer, festival time frame of all the new announcements. So that's where we're at right here at this podcast. So there's a lot of interesting topics here in terms of news, in terms of games we've been playing. And we'll just kind of take it from there. So in terms of games to talk about this week, I honestly don't know much of anything about this first title that is listed here. I saw that we covered it on our site. I saw that the title of the game. I saw we had it reviewed, but I don't know anything about this. It is Promise Mascot Agency. So I'm going to hand this off to James and others. I'm not sure who else has touched this game. I watched the launch trailer to try to like, all right, let me educate myself a little bit about what this game is. And having no context at all, what I look at this launch trailer for this game, which launched on the 10th, so a few days ago as the time of recording, and it reminds me of like those PS2 Mercenaries games, only you've got a giant mascot costume in like a back of a pickup truck that you're transporting or protecting or something, but I don't know what I'm talking about. So without further ado, Josh, educate our listeners. What is Promise Mascot Agency? What are your thoughts on it?
James, you educate, because I don't know either.
I meant James.
Yeah,
I think the two people on this podcast that have actually played it are me and Mikhail. So at least there's a couple of us that played it. So it is ostensibly a resource management simulation game where the whole thing is that you're a Yakuza that fucked up a job and lost 13, or was it 12 billion? 12 billion yen in this exchange between two families. And as a part of your redemption, you basically are forced to be exiled and you have to try and gather up as much money as you can by reviving this dead mascot agency. And, this game, it takes place in Japan, obviously, but it's an alternate Japan where all those like mascots you see for like all these different companies, especially in Japan, or not just in Japan, but mostly in Japan.
Certain cities even have their own mascots, right?
Yeah. Basically, in this one, it's like, yeah, those aren't people in suits, those are just basically the equivalent of stuff like yokai, where people are just people are just born as mascots and have abilities tied to that. And they're like real life people, like they're real, they're their own, like, I guess, organisms.
They're creatures and not necessarily humans in costumes.
Telling me gacha pin is real.
How does mascot procreation work?
These are hard questions.
That's the hard questions.
Yeah, let's not. But yeah, so it's, I guess the general gameplay loop is that at the start, you're just driving around in your beat up K truck driving around Kasamachi, which is this rural island town that's the setting of the game, and you're getting to know the different the different people that live there. You're getting to learn some of the history of the town, and while you're doing so, you're also finding mascots. You're finding parts of the town that need advertisement to try and help revive the town. And so you're getting these mascots, you're getting these jobs, and then you're sending them out while also using mascot support heroes, which are these different people you interact with, and also these cards you can find scattered around, literally just on the ground in the world, which at first your K-Truck, it's just pretty slow. It's not really a powerhouse, but very early on you find a side quest where it's like, hey, these spirit foxes have run off with this mechanic's blueprints for illegal modifications for K-Trucks, and it's like, ooh, give me some of that. And at first the game is very, very low-key, and I'd say it never really gets beyond that. I think one of the reasons why I wanted to cover this in the first place is I kind of had a mistaken impression about how much of a resource management game this would be. Once you get used to
it... In a good way or in a bad way? Is it more than you thought it would be?
Less than I thought it would be.
Oh, okay.
Which isn't a bad thing, to be clear. It's just the game itself... I feel like the gameplay loop does get very old very quickly, and without that, without that kind of danger of, because when you first start the game, there's no time limit. There's nothing that says that. But once you get into the groove, the game's like, okay, you probably know what you're doing now, so we're going to actually make it so your family's matriarch is 12 billion yen in debt because of you. If you do not send back money as you are going through each day, there's a meter that's literally a symbol of a katana coming down from the right to the left, counterclockwise. And if you do not send money, that meter will deplete, and eventually, if it fully depletes, the game will just be like, yeah, she's dead now. You need to restart from the last day and don't fuck it up this time. Which I was really interested in that. Just the resource management of, okay, you're getting this month, you're getting money from jobs. How much you spend on, say, upgrading parts of your mascot agency, or upgrade, or renovating parts of the town, or buying certain things that'll make your life easier, versus, okay, you need to send money back to her or she'll die.
What do you actually do in these jobs? So I'm a little bit conflicted, what's the actual gameplay of this game? I don't know if it's a racing game, a turn-based RPG. I'm not 100% sure.
So the way it works is that when you get into jobs, if jobs go well, you don't do anything. Mascot just handles things on their own. They didn't need any help. In that case, you literally don't do anything. It's just waiting for them to get back from their job. If they get in trouble...
So you send them out and then you're waiting for them to get back? You're just not doing anything?
Well, no, you're driving around, finding out more about the story, doing more stuff to, talking with new people, looking at different parts of Kasamachi, finding different things to do. There's only two parts of the game. There's the driving around, which is fun enough on its own, and then there's, if a mascot fucks up, you have to go into a mini game where all the mascot support heroes you got, and they're represented as cards that have different numbers for different types of problems that a mascot can run into. Let's say they've run into a problem where there's a swarm of bees. There's a swarm of bees, and they're just harassing the event. So if you have a mascot support hero that's really good at dealing with animals, you'll really want to hope that that one shows up when you load into trying to save the job. Because when you get mascot support heroes, it's completely randomized which one of those in your inventory shows up during a job. And that's like one thing that does get a little bit annoying, because you're not like deck building. You're not like building decks of support heroes and being like, these are the ones I want to rely on. It's like literally the game's like, okay, maybe you've upgraded like 90% of your support heroes, but we're going to give you the 10% that haven't been upgraded whatsoever for this end game job that mascot just fucked up. I hope you enjoy failing this job.
Like you said, there's two like gameplay like types. There's like one that's driving around and one that's like almost like a deck like turn based thing with these support heroes. Yeah. And the occasion that like there's a failed job, essentially.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the thing is that I was saying that I was hoping that the game had more resource management. Mm-hmm. And the other thing about the failing jobs is that there isn't really any downside to failing a job, because if anything, you still get a minimum amount of popularity for your mascot and the minimum amount of like payout from the job, even if you fuck it up.
So that's gonna be my question. Like, if it's RNG and you just get the shittiest hand dealt to you, and you're like, "Well, I'm not gonna save that job." Like, what's the consequence? And it sounds like not very much.
Yeah, very early on, you kind of can get to the point where you just power through everything. And while the story and all that is definitely charming, I had some specific issues with the framing of things. I definitely think this game overly glorifies the Yakuza a bit, and it's a very, very weird. But I don't know what to say. Maybe Mikhail, maybe you felt differently about that.
So I found it quite weird initially, because I didn't pay much attention to, I didn't try the demo except for when I got like I played it on Switch, Steam, and PS5 for the article. Because when I got the Steam and Switch versions, I heard that it had good DualSense functionality. So I said, like, let me get that and try that as well. So I got that. But when I started playing, I decided to stick with the Steam version. And when I started playing it, I found it, the open world stuff, a little interesting, because it might sound weird to say this, but I think out of the open world games which came out in the last 4 or 5 weeks, I think I enjoyed Promise Mascot Agency and Atelier Yumiya's open world more than Assassin's Creed Shadows. So, yeah, I think the open world random busy work which they give you, like, you know, early on you unlock the thing where you can shoot the pinky mascot to, like, save yourself
time. Oh, yeah,
that's
really, really funny. Yeah, it's so...
It basically lets you, like, there are a lot of random collectible things on the map. Like, there are gates which you can only open by once you unlock this ability to, like, shoot, like, a bazooka thing where it just shoots the mascot, like, with an auto aim. You also use that to collect garbage, which gives you some, I think it gives you a bit of money and fame. And then there are those, the mayor signboards all over, which also raise your fame level and stuff like that. So usually you'd have to drive over these things and collect them manually, but after you unlock this ability, you just have to be near it and you can just keep spamming R1 and it'll just fire the pinky mascot at all these things. That was really funny. As for the story, it definitely feels like it reminded me of No More Heroes, the way, you know, how the storytelling is in those games where you have, they want to tell you something where I think the director has everything written down and they have their story which they want to tell you from start to finish, but the gameplay kind of is at odds with it in some way. But I felt like Promise Mascot Agency pulled that off better, because while the gameplay, like you said, the resource management and the RNG stuff, and when you fail some of those jobs, at some point in the game there's a light bulb that goes off in your head that there isn't that much of urgency to a lot of things, except for when you have to, like, start sending money back. I think that's how I felt, where you can just ignore a lot of things and just take things as they go, but you just need to focus on sending money back, otherwise you'll get the game over. I think there's, like, this cutoff point in the game where after a certain point, you will need to just focus on that, and I think that's when it goes into the thing where the autosaves start, like, doing day 1, day 2, and day 3, if I'm remembering correctly. So yeah, I haven't finished it yet. I'm like, because I was playing it on three different platforms, I ended up sticking with the Steam version. I think I'm like 25 hours in, but still not close to finishing it because I've been doing a lot of stuff. I should be able to finish it before next week, but so far I really enjoyed the game. I like almost everything about it except for this RNG thing with those jobs. But then I feel like that, I don't know, it doesn't feel like that specific, the card mechanic thing for those jobs was fully thought out, because I don't know, it just feels a bit tacked on in how you have to play those, because there's, I feel like if they had put more time into letting you build your deck and doing stuff manually, it would have been nicer, so that whenever you get one of those alerts that there's some, one of your mascots has a problem and you have to save the job, maybe if there's a like a higher difficulty or something which lets you straight up lose the money from that job, maybe that would make it more interesting, if you can create your own deck, you know, specifically for a job and then do it. Because right now I didn't feel like that bit was done well in the game.
It feels like the way you guys are describing it, that they had a neat idea for like a game concept in terms of utilizing the fun idea of these city mascots or company mascots to solve advertising problems. At least that's the way I've parsed it so far. But then the way that they implement the game is all random, which feels like it kind of takes away.
I think some aspects of it are random, but I feel like the game in general is like super ambitious for the studio. So I feel like they accomplished what they wanted to do in some ways, but the execution of certain aspects was not as good as the others. Like, if I think about the parts I love from the game, I like the voice acting a ton, because they got, like, Kuroda, who's Kiryu's voice actor, and it's super funny hearing him over here again playing a Yakuza. And then they have, like, a lot of unexpected talent as well, because they have, like, Shuhei Yoshida doing one of the voices as well, which was a little funny.
That's really
yeah,
good.
But then
I didn't know that.
I think the voice acting and the music were like absolutely fantastic. Like, soundtrack is one of my favorites.
Soundtrack's incredible. That makes sense though, because Paradise Killer also had an incredible soundtrack. So
yeah, so like with that angle, like when I played Paradise Killer, I was like, okay, the second game from them, are they gonna live up to what I want from them? But they actually exceeded it in many ways, but also in some ways I wasn't too happy with it. So I think in the end, I'm very positive on Promise Mascot Agency. I haven't finished it yet, but so far I like it a lot, but I can see areas where they can improve in patches and stuff like that. Like, maybe even if they work on this specific, you know, the card game mode and stuff like that. But I want to, you one like non-story and non-soundtrack related thing. You ran into some Unreal Engine stutter stuff, right? I think it's Unreal Engine, unless I'm mixing it up, because too many games on right now.
I don't think it's Unreal Engine. I think it's a custom engine. They just don't do shader pre-compilation for DX12. But thankfully, it doesn't take too long for... You're going to run into a stutter, and it was definitely not as bad on my end, because... Again, I have a system that can kind of power through. You still feel it, but the stutters last like less time. And since you're going to be driving around the same town so much, it doesn't take very long to kind of just like
It fixed itself eventually. But yeah, that was just something I wasn't sure about when I was playing it, because whenever I play a game on like Steam Deck and it runs a certain way, and then I try it on like the ROG Ally, which is way more powerful, and you start having performance issues there, you start pinning things down on like Windows and, you know, shader related stuff and also but so just music was really good. So did you like it more or less than Paradise Killer, out of curiosity?
Well, thing is, I actually haven't finished Paradise Killer. Like, most of my experience with that was watching friends play it, which I guess in that sense is pretty similar, because it's also very much a narrative game. So seeing someone play through it, I need to get around to it. I just knew from what I saw that it was like, I liked the vibes of it. I liked the soundtrack. I liked the story. This one, I think that I like the idea of the story, but like I said, there was just like one or two things that I don't want to go into spoilers with, but the way that they kind of like
You can't say it.
I just think that they they valorize the Yakuza a bit much when it's like, that's, you guys are a British studio. That feels very weird.
Oh, I didn't have that context.
Yeah, I think if anyone just watched the trailers, they would have no idea this is from a British studio, because it's very Japanese through and through with its aesthetic.
And
it's like,
to be clear, they did work directly with Japanese creators, and they did work. So it's like, I'm not like, not about that, and I don't want to really focus on that. It's just like, I did like the heart of what they were saying in the story. I did think that the writing was very good in some aspects. I just had a bugbear about how it felt like some specific things that they were really focusing on near the end was like, that is a bit odd. But yeah.
So as James and Mikhail have kind of alluded to, James has written up a review for Promise Mascot Agency up on the site at rpgsite.net. And then Mikhail was able to do the spec or the comparison between, was it just Steam Deck and Ally, or what else was there?
No, it was Steam Deck, it was Ally, it was Nintendo Switch and PS5. And I mainly
wanted to do the Nintendo Switch. That's interesting.
Yes. So that's one of the main things I wanted to focus on, because usually when you have games which are like just on PlayStation 5, Series X and Steam, and they might skip Switch, or, you know, at this point you'd think they're coming to Switch 2, but which apparently the developer did say they want to bring it to Switch 2, but it's on base Switch, and I think they did a really good job with the port, all things considered. And I was actually laughing that it was running like with it's obviously like a lower frame rate than on the other platforms, but it did not bother me as much as it did on playing on the ROG Ally, because there was no stuttering on Switch, which is funny. But yeah, there was no demo on Switch at all, while the other platforms had a pre-release demo. So that's another thing which I was like, I'm hoping they're not hiding the game with no demo and stuff. But yeah, it turned out pretty decent, I think.
And then James or Mikhail, did you have any other final comments on Promise Mascot Agency? But thank you for kind of going through exactly what the game is like for us who are out of the loop.
I think I'm going to just keep playing more of it, and hopefully I can finish it and talk about it in brief when I get on the next podcast, because I am enjoying it, but I've had to put it on hold for like other games which are coming out soon, which can talk about in a bit. So yeah.
I did enjoy the game. You can tell because my review was a 7, which is a good score. I just felt like, as I was saying, that the gameplay does get pretty old by the end, and then it's just like, it really depends on how you feel about the story. And I thought the story was good, but had some issues, and you can't really go into any specifics in a review like that. So
I definitely agree with you about the gameplay. Like it's for a lot of people, it definitely will get boring because you're doing pretty much the same thing. And if people don't like this vibe of exploring, you know, driving around the truck in this rural quote unquote cursed place, which curses Yakuza and stuff like that, I think that'll also turn a lot of people off. But for some reason, just driving around and with the music and stuff, I kind of use this as like a nice break game as well when I'm not doing like a ton of Mizutsune. But yeah, I think that's it for the
cool. But yeah, we do have the review up on the site, rpgsite.net, for Promise Mascot Agency, as well as the Steam Deck, ROG Ally, Switch comparison, PS5 as well for that. Before we get to the next topic, just two more features on the site is that we also have a review for AI Limit that was written by Junior. We weren't able to get Junior on the podcast for a couple reasons, but he did cover that game for us. He did like it a fair bit. His main two critiques were that it was very buggy, so much so Junior is cursed. He had like his save file break and he couldn't like reload an old save. It was just toast. So I don't know, Adam, if he talked to you like behind the scenes, like if you had to restart or reach out to PR or anything.
I think he just had to restart.
Oh, wow. So he said, yeah, technical issues for AI Limit. Otherwise, he thought it was pretty good, just safe. And that's a game that I've also been interested in ever since it debuted initially like 7 years ago, even though it's got a fairly different coat of paint on it now than how it's released. But we do have that review up on the site as well. And then we also have another feature. This is kind of a natural falling out of the Switch 2 detailing. Of course, on this podcast last week and a little bit the week before, we talked about all the different things announced within our site's purview for the Switch 2. So Mikhail put it in a listicle format about RPGs playable on Switch 2, so new RPGs, Switch 2 editions, you know, what's coming out at launch, what's coming out after launch assigned to Switch 2, what other things have mentioned a planned Switch 2 release. So, of course, a lot of those things we've detailed as they've been announced, but if you want just a quick reference, Mikhail, you did an excellent job kind of putting that listicle together.
Yeah, they don't make it easy. It's the whole thing's confusing. So, and if I mean, like it almost changes on a daily basis too, based on what people find out. You know, going through sites, reaching out to Nintendo themselves, etc. It's a mess. So,
good job. And I think I've seen box art changes for games like Rune Factory and Story of Seasons, the Grand Bazaar, like on multiple retailers. Like I think I forget if it's these two games, but I saw some game which was listed like a normal Nintendo Switch game in North America, but in Australia it was listed as a Nintendo Switch edition. Now, from what I understand, based on talking to friends in Japan and looking through 5 different region eShops, I believe that if a game is called Nintendo Switch Edition, there will be an upgrade path offered for people who have like the Switch, the original Switch, or it's basically going to offer an upgrade path, while a game which is just listed for Nintendo Switch 2 and Nintendo Switch 1 will not have an upgrade path. This is purely speculation based on what I've read on different eShop listings and stuff like that. So yeah. I wanted to be clear about that, because it's like when I was doing the Game Pass, like the best RPGs on Game Pass. Obviously, I can't say the best Nintendo Switch 2 RPGs because we've not played many of these or like played any of them on Switch. I know Adam has played. I mean, we have his hands-on from last week, but basically with the Game Pass thing, they have so many different tiers of Game Pass that it was a mess trying to find out what's on what. So when I was doing the Switch 2 thing, I just straight up said in the beginning to myself that I am not including Switch 1 games via backward compatibility, because then there'll be like thousands on this. So yeah. I put a link to Kite's article because he did a good job putting together. We spoke about it before. There's a they put up I think 100 or 120 games which have some issues on Switch 2 in backward compatibility, and he put up a list of the RPGs on that, like Final Fantasy Pixel Remaster, just the first one, and like Knights of Azure 2, I think, and some other games like that. So I just put a link to that for people who are curious about the Switch 1 stuff. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to like keep adding to this over time, because there are definitely going to be more RPGs announced, and I assume there are going to be more Nintendo Switch 2 editions from Nintendo for their first party. You know, yeah, like there's so many games which we like, I'm sure all of us want Nintendo Switch 2 editions. Like Adam mentioned, Fire Emblem Three Houses. I'd absolutely be up for that. I'd probably pay $30 for that over paying for something like Mario Party. So like, that's where I am with that game. So yeah, I'm going to be interesting to see how this list builds over time. And I'm probably going to morph into a list where I just put like the best RPGs, because I'm sure in like a year or two, this is going to have like hundreds of games with how Switch was. So
it's an evolving situation. Then you can curate it down a little bit. All to best.
A lot of these is when the rubber meets the road type of thing, because there's going to be, I'm sure, going to be more clarifications and different situations of like what was communicated before and what actually released. It's going to be a mess. Like, you know, we're only pre-release, and when actual releases start flowing in, it's going to be a mess. And you know, but personally, I wish there wasn't any paid upgrades. It was just like all free upgrades. Especially because the pricing at this point for a lot of these things is like out of control, and it's only going to get worse.
I mean, we just found out about the Breath of the Wild thing, right? Like, it doesn't have the DLC included. Yeah. So
crazy.
So if
confirmed.
Yeah, so it's and even the $10 or like $9.99 to be specific upgrade price for the thing. So like, if someone has to buy Breath of the Wild right now and wants everything, they need to spend $70 for the Nintendo Switch 2 edition and then spend $20 for the expansion pass. Obviously, if you have the expansion pass and the base game, like I'm sure many of us here do, then you just need to pay for the upgrade if you want like the visual and performance improvements and the Zelda note stuff. But yeah, it's kind of disappointing. And because of this, now you have different physical editions of the game. Like in Japan, they did a physical edition of Breath of the Wild, which actually had all the DLC on cartridge for Nintendo Switch 1. So now you're going to have a new physical edition, which seemingly has, if we go by reports from what Nintendo is saying, that it'll have the Switch 2 upgrade and the base game on the cartridge, but you still have to buy the DLC. So yeah, like Josh said, this is like just, it's a mess. We need them to actually put out a statement and update the website instead of relying on customer service reps and statements which may or may not tell us the full story. Because, you know, the statement which they said about the Switch 2 upgrade and the Switch 1 game on cartridge, and it's a Switch 2 cartridge, it doesn't actually like be specific and say there will be no download required for this with no patches and stuff. So, yeah, it's just, as someone who likes collecting physical games for games, I like, yeah, still quite a bit of a mess. So we'll see how things go.
Yeah, I would just recommend people just wait till things like start existing, you know, and see what, like, you know, what people say when they see it on the shelves, and what happens when they go home and, you know, actually open that box and see what's inside. It feels like, you know, it's like Pandora's box at the moment. So, you know, it'll get unveiled. It'll just, you know, take time for people to kind of get used to how they're rolling things out. Yeah, it's, you know, we'll see.
I actually feel like we need more infographics. We need like tables and charts and like arrows. I need someone to say like, here, like, I need more of these. I want to be able to like look at two axes on a chart and feel like this game is releasing digital for this price with this upgrade. Like, but instead we just kind of have scattershot of this PR agent said in this country for this thing on this part of the website or whatever. And it's just like, ugh.
Okay, I was just double checking to make sure, but I don't think it's been officially revealed yet. When, like, there was some reporting, I think yesterday at the time of this recording, people were saying, oh, the new pre-order date for US and Canada for Switch was May 8th, but then I went to go search it up, and apparently that wasn't the case, and that's not official. So at the moment, I don't think the May 8th date for the new pre-order for Switch 2 on
So what happened is, it was supposed to be, from what I understand, that people who got an invite on My Nintendo were going to be given purchase dates of May 8th. That was how it was supposed to be. So this was how it was always planned, that May 8th was going to be one of the purchase dates for My Nintendo. But what happened is, when Nintendo put out the statement about they need to assess the tariffs and stuff like that, I believe that they delayed the pre-orders, but they said the console is launching still set for June 5th. They didn't actually change this May 8th thing. So I think IGN was the one that reported it, and they said that this is the new pre-order date, but that actually wasn't the date. It was just
something I saw that Nintendo going around, and I was like, is that really the new date? Like, it's like I said, it's once again an evolving situation that, like, it's so, you have to be really, like, your ear has to be close to the road to, like, or to the ground to, like, just know what the fuck is happening on a daily basis.
There was also like the reports that Mario Kart Tour is $90, and it's like, no, it's not.
Like,
this is where that Digital Trends article from Giovanni is absolutely worth reading, because he like looked into how this $90 Mario Kart thing started spreading and what the source was and what corrections were made. And basically, it was just an article about how misinformation spreads and you need to be more diligent with, like, knowing. Yeah, so that was absolutely worth, I think it's worth reading. So, yeah.
Mm. I'll just to double back again a bit before the Switch stuff on AI Limit. Like, I had a friend who played AI Limit right after he finished First Berserker Kazan. And he's like, I think I prefer the story in AI Limit better than Kazan.
Ah.
from someone, the firsthand account of, like, hey, who played Kazan and AI Limit, I think he preferred AI Limit overall than Kazan. And part of that is because it had a better story to it that resonated more with him. Even though a lot of that storytelling method was just, like, you know, talking to NPCs and what they told him. Stuff. So I'm interested in checking it out, but I can't do Souls like back to back. I need some time to go for the next one. I'm not built like him.
I need to get around to finally playing Lies of P in time for that DLC.
Yeah.
So before we go on to the news, which luckily is a little lighter today, we've earmarked some time here for a few of our podcast participants to talk about what they've been up to in terms of, obviously, we're all playing recent releases like Xenoblade, obviously still playing Monster Hunter Wilds and its title updates and things like that. But you have been playing, you call this your degeneracy corner, Josh.
It's degeneracy all the way down from here.
Yeah, so I have no context. I have some context, but very little. Mm-hmm. Outside of Xenoblade and Monster Hunter and a few other things that have released in February, March, and early April, what else have you been up to?
you know, I'm a person that's boots on the ground. You know, I'm willing to go to places where no one likes to go. Right. I'm a pioneer. I like to go explore on my own and find out things on my own. So I'm currently playing this this hit mobile game called Puella Magi, Madoka Magica, Magia, etc. I know it's a long title, and you know, that's my design.
Now, there was an older mobile game of this franchise, but this is a newer one.
Correct. So this is the old one that you're referring to that's now out of service both in globally and Japan was Madoka Magica Magia Record. And this is the sort of follow-up sequel to it. It's hard to say, really, but yes, this is the gacha game corner degeneracy, as I put on the document. Because when there are games, especially for IPs that I like, I will often give them a shot and try to be fair and, you know, and see where it goes. Like, in a few days, there's a new G-Generation gacha game called G-Generation Eternal coming out that has a shitload of Gundams, and I like that series. And I'm like, if this is where I have to go for my G-Generation, then so be it. I've gone to maybe weirder places with that series. So yeah, this is kind of a weird one because it's a turn-based RPG. It is, if you see a battle screenshot of this game, and many people have, especially when it was first announced, they're like, they called it Madoka Star Rail because, and it's kind of weird, right? Because like when people make that comparison based on like screenshots they see in this game, some people out there will kind of interpret that in bad faith, say that like, so you're just, it's just like any turn-based JRPG. It's like, no, they're saying that because the UI, the placement of icons, where everything else is, and the iconography is very similar to Madoka Star Rail in terms of like, turn order is stylized this way, where the elemental weaknesses are, the break gauge gameplay, even though it's a little bit different here, it's very heavily inspired by Honkai Star Rail, where the basic attacks and the skill attacks and like the placement of like where your party members are on that user interface is very similar to Honkai Star Rail. It's, they make no, you know, there's no way out of like, hey, they were probably inspired by like a really, really popular game in the same space that's a turn-based JRPG and is very popular and is making a lot of money at the moment. You know, that's, there's no, you know, you don't have to be ashamed of that and like try to interpret that in bad faith as like, it's just, why are you just comparing it to Honkai Star Rail or just like any other turn-based RPG? It's like, no, they look like the same fucking game.
They're being pretty transparent with their inspirations.
Yeah.
I mean, like, a lot of games use the same UI and stuff. I mean,
yeah,
it's not like their games didn't like take their UI from other games too, right?
Yeah, it's just like, hey, that's what's popular at the moment. This is what's working for people, and you know, and probably both of them have done market analysis. Like, hey, it's intuitive to lay out our UI like this other game because you know people who enjoy turn-based JRPGs on like mobile interfaces, like you know, this UI works for them. So on some level, you know, it's also about accessibility. If they're trying to, you know, try this game after Honkai Star Rail. Anyway, this game's weird, right? Because it's kind of a follow-up to already another gacha game that went out of service years ago. It was pretty successful and beloved over in Japan. And globally, it was like several years late, and it kind of died prematurely even before the Japanese servers closed up. Like a lot of people felt really burned by how Magia Record was handled, the global version of it. This one is simultaneous in the territories that that it's available in. I hesitate to say worldwide simultaneous because there's a lot of like territories around the world that's region locked from playing this game. So it's not, it's quote unquote worldwide, but with a big asterisk that only in the territories where it's being served. So it's not like out of sync out of the Japanese server and whatnot. It's like whenever an update hits, it's for both. It's for all versions of the game that at the moment. So it's all synced up. Unlike Magia Record, which had a staggered release global and was treated
as a separate thing. Does that mean that technically JP and the rest of the world are on the same server?
I think so. I think, like, when it comes to, because there is like actually no, I don't think they're the same, because there's guilds in it called Unisons, and you need to be on the same region to be in the same guild as other people. So they have to all be either Japanese server or global server. So they're different. So I'm not saying that, like, hey, this might get prematurely shut down in one territory. It's not like Dragalia Lost or something where, like, everything was, like, connected, from what I remember. Yeah, so the premise of this, it's like, it's the story, the original story in this game has yet to actually, like, start. And that's a weird thing to say. So the premise of this game, and I guess this will get into, like, Madoka Magica stuff, so I'll try to explain that along the way as much as possible. Where you're, like, you have this blank void of a main character. Like, the main character is really, like kind of like just a black void with, like, white dots and a mouth as eyes. But, like, they don't really have, like, a character design to them yet. And we don't know if that's going to be unveiled later or what. They're basically a kind of like a blank slate main character. You give them a name, but they don't really know. They don't have any memories. They don't really know what's going on. They're kind of like in this timeless space along with this creature that looks like Kyubey from the anime. But people know it's like kind of almost like a weasel rabbit-esque alien thing. Not a good character in that show. Kind of a major villain as that show goes on. But it kind of resembles that creature, Kyubey. But their name is AQ, and they're a different entity from Kyubey. And they serve as kind of your guide, and the story flow of this game so far is all recaps both of the original series and also a recap of, like, the beginning of the original story from the previous mobile game Magia Record. So you go through, like, the arcs of the TV series. It's kind of, like, kind of weird calling them arcs. It was only, like, a 12 or 13 episode TV series that has, like, you know, compilation movies as well. But there's definitely, like, hey, you meet different characters of the five main characters, that they all have their own separate, like, arcs going through that show in it. And that's how that's kind of divided up. Because it's not like an open world game. It's a very traditional... I kind of hesitate to say old school, because it's not that old, but it is kind of quote unquote old school, in the sense that, like, you go into a stage that has, like, an overworld map view, but you travel to each, you traverse through it through nodes, and these nodes could either be like a battle node, a flashback mode, a node which is like kind of this a very simple scene recapping stuff from the show. Or an exploration stage, which is basically running through, like, a narrow corridor to the end. Sometimes there'll be a branching path and an optional battle that you can do for goodies. But for the most part, you know, it's very, very simple in that regard in terms of, like, what the actual structure of the gameplay stages are. Which is, most of it is just battling. Some of it is running through very linear corridors that has battle and stuff. And it's kind of interesting because it leans on the strengths of the Madoka IP, in the sense that, like, it has really strong art direction, because Madoka Magica in general has strong art directions where enemies, which are witches in the show, run at a different frame rate than the rest of the game. Or, like, kind of, they have, like, that stop motion, jittery motion to them, much like the show, to kind of show, like, accentuate, like, that they're, like, a foreign entity. They're, like, they're kind of, like, weird and out of touch with reality. And each of these, like, stages that you're wandering through has, like, a bizarre looking atmosphere, because they're in witches' labyrinths. And for people who know the show or are familiar with it, like, whenever these magical girls go fight off witches, they're usually, like, in their own separate realm. Where, like, there's, like, a lot of, like, bizarre artistic imagery that has, it has really bizarre, like, atmospheric imagery, where one could be, like, just, like, a realm full of film reels with, like, scenes of the show running in tandem and random through these film reels. One could be like a dessert style atmosphere where like all of like the ground and like the background parts are all candy. But it's all like in within a tinge of like it's kind of like a more horror-esque haunting imagery. It's not like a happy filled, you know, atmosphere at all. And so forth. And one of the cooler ones is like, well, when you're going to like one of the big bosses near the end of the show, is like the whole stage is like collapsed buildings floating in the air. It's like the range and the motif of like these stages and the art design of the enemies and the bosses are like very, it leans on the strength of that IP, which is like very, very strong art direction. Also has great music, but that's also because the show in general and the IP has really great music, and this is helmed by none other than Yuki Kajiura, who actually, you know, composed a new theme song for this game with the Fiction Junction project that she does. So there's a lot of like, you know, it tugs at my heartstrings because I'm a big Yuki Kajiura fan. I'm a big fan of the art direction of the Madoka series.
It's really unfortunate. I'm just going to chime in just to say it's really unfortunate that Kajiura never did another video game after Xenosaga 2 and 3. She's done a lot of anime. Just no more
video games. I hear you. I really hear you.
It's actually kind of fun because like my girlfriend is more of an anime watcher than a video game player, but whenever I'm listening to the soundtrack like in the car and it's Xenosaga, I forget if it's 2 or 3 that Yuki worked on.
Both.
She's like, oh, this sounds like Yuki Kajiura. And I'm like, yep. And this is, I think, her last video game credit is Xenosaga 3. Yep.
I know. I hear you. I cry
that
every
soundtrack
time.
Soundtrack 3 is so good.
And the series that's most prevalent with Kajiura's music these days, I think, is like Sword Art Online.
Yes, she's done like all of Sword Art.
Yeah. It's like, you know, I'm not saying that like SAO is terrible, but I wish she worked on something better consistently. So the battles themselves in this game, turn-based RPG, it's very, I forgot exactly how Hawkeye Star Rail worked. So for people, Chow, you tell me, you remind me, because I only played that for a little bit. In that game, there are two gauges, an HP bar and a break bar. When you break enemies in Honkai Star Rail, do they ever replenish those break gauges?
They do. It takes a couple of turns. It's basically, you have to like do as much damage as you can before they get their turn back, right?
Yeah, but do they recover it? Do they recover it on like the
They recover the entire thing.
I know, but like once you break an enemy on the next turn that they get after they break, do they replenish that break gauge immediately?
Yeah, that works.
Okay, because I thought in Honkai it's either they never replenished it, or it took them a couple turns.
They republish a couple, like as soon as they get their turn back. But there are some characters that will delay their turn once you get, like, once they break, and that's why those characters are considered like broken. There's a character like called Ranmei, and as soon as a character, like, you break them, their turn is basically like delayed to the roof. So you get like 4 extra turns, like, to like DPS them, right? Yeah. So it's like very broken, in my opinion, right?
Yeah, so
this, it's like, okay. I'm not being like exactly accurate on how to explain this, but it's just like kind of like a paraphrasing on how it sort of works, right?
Yeah, so this game works very similarly, where like every single enemy has 2 gauges, an HP gauge and a break gauge, and then there's different classes of each of the magical girls that you obtain either through the, I think you can only obtain it through the gacha. There's no like free one aside from like the pre-registration bonus. There's attackers, there's breakers. Attackers are obviously better at dealing HP damage. Breakers are good at dealing breaker damage. There's healers. Defenders are ones that are, they can give you a shield on your characters. And buffers and debuffers. And you only have up to 5 people in a party at a time. So you have to kind of balance out what you want the chemistry of your party to be from those. Obviously your basic goal in battle is to, especially during bosses, because the grunt enemy is not so much of a threat. They do become more of a threat like in higher difficulty stages, but in general, your main objective is breaking the enemy as fast as possible and trying to keep them broken as long as possible, because when they're broken, there's a multiplier that shows up that you can crank up through attacks, and obviously you want to get that attack multiplier as high as you can, so when you
it's a staggered age.
Yeah, when it's an attacker's turn under attack multiplier, they can deal a lot of damage, because it's like 400%, you do a shitload more damage on that. And like you were saying, Chad, they're starting to introduce characters can delay enemy attacks, manipulate turn order, and raise speed, debuff speed, decrease damage, etc. It has all those the inner workings, those mechanics that I'm sure Honkai has explored as well, and other turn-based RPGs have done this forever as well. But it's just their direct comparisons because of the way that they're presented and how their UI is very similar to one another. I think what's interesting about this game in terms of the battle economy is that they actually have a toggle option in the settings where you can display the numerical value of your action in upcoming turns. So let's say it's Madoka's turn, and the next turn is Homura's turn. There'll be a number by her that'll say that can span from 0 to 100. And it's basically an indicator of how quote unquote close is the next turn. So let's say the next turn for Homura was at 15, and Madoka has a buff that she can grant to raise speed. So that you have you could actually have a cross reference of how much speed her buff gives based on how much that number is raised on the next incoming. So it's kind of assigning hard numerical values on how close the next turn is actually to someone, which is kind of an interesting nerdy thing to think about. But it's I'm a sucker for numbers that that surface metadata like that. In general, and it's just it's there's a lot of interesting tactics already being explored with it, but obviously the big caveat is, hey, this is a gacha game, and this game is fucking stingy when it comes to gacha pools and currency, how much you earn currency. This is developed between two very cursed companies. It's developed by the original developers of Magia Record, F4 Samurai, which, they're not the most reputable, highly reputable people. And then you have Pokelabo as the other. Pokelabo, people have mixed feelings on them. They've done stuff like Sinnoh Alice. I think they also
worked on that game's very stingy as well.
I think they also did Near Reincarnation, I believe. And
That was Applebot.
Oh, sorry, Applebot. That might have been Applebot. But
one of the few I played.
There we go. Good job. Yeah. So Aniplex is publishing this, obviously, because they have ownership of the Madoka IP, and the way that all the gacha stuff like Kitty, how much currency earned daily. Stuff like that is just it's really, really stingy. I don't want to go through the inner workings, because that would take forever. But it's just for example, pity carryover isn't a thing in this game. When a banner ends, the pity doesn't transfer to a new banner, and there's multiple banners already, and the game's only been out for
to ask you, when you see the turn order, it shows you the numbers, right?
Yeah.
I don't know why in Honkai Star Rail it hides the number, and you had to go for the setting to turn it on.
This one hides it by default, but you can you can turn it on.
Oh, I guess they did copy the same thing though.
Yeah. So, I'm not sure. I kind of want to stay with this game until it gets a Steam release, because it was announced for mobile and Steam, but they delayed the Steam version to touch that up. There is charm to it in the sense that, like, you need to... all the gacha stuff, obviously not charming. Even like, getting to the story, the story has been all recapped so far. It's kind of weird in the sense that, like, the production values on the story themselves is, like, inconsistent, because, like, the Madoka Magica main series has, like, you know, it's fully voiced, has all, like, you know, these kind of goes through each, like, major scene in the game and recreates it in the game, and so forth. But when it comes to, like, recapping the beginning of, like, the Magia Record original story, it's, like, the story scenes aren't voiced at all. It's kind of rushed. Like, the flashback, like, it doesn't really have flashback mode stages in that one. And it just feels, like, really oddly rushed, where, like, it's really accelerating, like, the events, you know, retelling the events of that game, where, like, you kind of get the spark notes, but it's kind of, it feels more hastily paced than the original. And then they also do, like, spin-offs of, like, Madoka Magica Universe stuff. Like, the main story stages that I'm on is for a side story spin-off called, like, Oriko Magica, which was, like, I believe, like, the prototype story of Magia Record or something like that, or the original scenario before that game came out. I don't know. It's fucking weird.
When you said earlier that the original anime only had, like, 12 episodes, I'm like, as someone who's a normie in this context, I'm like, that can't be right. I've seen this all over the place. I'm like, oh, there's, like, the original series and a spin-off series, then recap movies, and then an original movie, and then a bunch of different... I'm like, oh, okay, it's just as big as I thought it was, and it's a little bit impenetrable if you don't have a foot in.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think people will be fine if you just, like, watch the original series and then, you know, the Rebellion movie. There's, like, a new movie also in the works that's going to come out soon that's, like, a sequel to that. So it's not like...
People have been waiting for that fourth movie for a decade. I remember waiting for that fourth movie when I was in high school. My 10th year reunion for my high school is this year.
I attended the LA premiere of Rebellion. Those were good times. I got a Homer coffee mug.
I remember when the show first aired or something like that. I think my friend messaged me on S, and you gotta watch this. This is darker than Gundam.
I mean, the darker stuff is like, it's like, it was shocking at that time, but like so many other shows, you know, is very influential in the sense that, like, for better and for worse, you know, like, you know, it kind of spawned off, like, hey, people like the dark spin on, like, magical girl stuff. And that was kind of, you know, it's because Madoka Magica took off. So everyone tried to recreate their own version of that, which I don't think it set a great precedent, but, like, you know, that people always chase trends because they want to be the next.
Yeah, and it doesn't help that a lot of the shows and, like, manga that have come since then have very much missed the point, it feels like.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of a very specific one that you probably can already guess which one I'm thinking of, but yeah.
There's so much I don't actually know, because there's a lot that comes to mind. Sight?
Yeah.
Can you tell me, in anime-wise, who started the trend of the one where you're like, there's like a party member and the guy gets kicked out and he turns out to be the most OP person in the party member?
I don't know, dude. That sounds like three other or four other things. I don't know. There's so many.
Trope. Okay, there's like three anime tropes that they always make these days. It's either isekai and this guy turns out to be like a level 99 character, or there's the one where they have four party members to kick out the guy that seems useless, and then he turns out to be like the most OP crap, and then I forgot what the third one is.
There's even like subgenres that are seen, like it's like an isekai but there's smartphones involved. It's like, okay, that's like five other, like there's at least five other shows that have that premise.
I just don't know who started this trend. Who wrote this? Now everyone's making their own knockoff of it.
So yeah, I don't know. Like, I think there's some charm to it, but I'm very hesitant. Like, I'm very like, I'll do the basic daily stuff and play it on my own time here and there. But I wonder if I'll like it more, like, when it comes to Steam, because, like, you know, the phone performance is okay, but like not really great. And I wonder, like, and I think a lot of people are just like not happy with like the state that the game is in terms of like they're not really generous, they're pretty stingy, and it kind of gives me a tiny bit of hope, maybe a little bit of cope here that like maybe that it will eventually get better once the devs acknowledge that like there are problems with it eventually.
Look, if it's near end of service, it'll get super generous.
Oh yeah,
it'll be like, hey, have you played Knights of Astra? Remember that, or Knights of Veda?
Was that Knights of Veda?
Knights of Veda.
I played that a little bit when it first came out.
It was like so fucking stingy. It copied like the whole universe gacha model one for one. And yeah, now apparently they scrapped like everything. It'll be like, oh, now you don't lose the 50-50 anymore because apparently it made a lot of player base quit. And then it's like everything. And they give you like so much like free pulls and you're like, yep, they knew they fucked up, but it's too late.
Yeah, it's like I know it's like giga generous now. That's good.
It's like, yeah.
And then the other lesser-known gacha game that I've been, you know, once again, pioneering my way through is... this was kind of an interesting one. It's like, it's an indie one. It's called Black Beacon, and it's by ex-Kuro Game staff that used to work on Punishing Grey Raven. They quit that studio and made their own studio. I forgot what the new studio is called now, the ones who created Black Beacon. But this one is kind of pretty ambitious for their size. This one's an action RPG, but the premise is really weird. It's original, but it has the Tower of Babel aesthetic to it, where the main focus of the story is this ever build this tower that's been being built throughout every era in human history, like all the way back from like Mesopotamia all the way to like the space age. Like there's this mysterious tower that that civilization has kept on building all the way through like outer space. So like even like the opening movie imagery is like you have the starting tower, like square tower that's just vertically going up all the way past through like the space, and the mysteries of this tower is like every single record of like humanity, past, present, and future is like contained in like all in like this myriad of like labyrinthian library archives in this tower. And your main character is known as the Seer, and they are like the successor to a character named Cosmos, and they are like kind of the, I guess almost like the bookkeeper of the tower, where they have the power to like time travel within the tower. So a lot of like the storytelling in it is really, really disjointed in a very deliberate manner, where like you start a stage and like the story is like 20 years before the world calendar, and then the next stage is like 3 years ago. And so like you're kind of like piecing together where events are taking place, but the main like first arc, for example, is there's an incident that happens on the first day that you're introduced to this tower, and you're pulled far flung into the future, and you see one of these characters named Arishon, this pink haired woman, who like you are facing this entity that kind of looks like a golden cube inside the tower. You don't know how far in the future this is, but you know that like in the a result of that encounter is Arishon pushes you off right before that entity self-destructs and kills her. So as that self-destructs, you're pushed back into the past, and you have to figure out what is that entity that self-destructed, and what can you do to prevent that from self-destructing, which killed Arishon. So that's kind of the first main mystery that you're working through, and you're introduced to kind of like your sidekick Zero and all these other characters that fill in the world of this tower, because there are some characters that are like sort of architects that know a little bit more of the inner workings of this tower, how the time travel manipulation system works. There are like terms like where there's this concept called the Path of No Return, where there are there's like an exploration faction that eventually finds their calling in within the tower, and they like set off on a journey to never return to where they came from, and they're only pushing forward to continue building the tower forward. And one of the earliest like main quote unquote main characters you meet are like sort of like these characters that like share a sibling relationship, but one of them is like a genius but cocky, and the other is like somewhat less of a genius but more stable and, you know, more reserved and so forth. And she's trying to like prevent her brother like figure from going on his path of no return, because she's seen like, you know, where his path goes, where like kind of, I guess, like perishes alone and stuff like that. So there's like a lot of like interesting world building stuff on like this Tower of Babel aesthetic. And it's not an open world or anything. It's like, it's once again stages, and you use stamina to go through these stages. And there's like, it's primarily an isometric action RPG view, where you can move. Your character has a basic attack string. You have two skills and then an ultimate. There's also an environmental skill where like in the first environment that you're in, like this library that you're kind of getting the inner workings of, you can like temporarily freeze enemy in a time bubble, and you can like do like a burst, like a chrono burst in them when you attack them enough times when they're frozen in that bubble. And you can deploy up to three characters, and you slot them in and out. They have that whole dynamic of like, hey, there's like some of them have off-field attack effects. Some of them is like you want to swap them in to debuff them, and then swap them out for your like main DPS to attack enemies when they're debuffed, etc., etc. Like some of them have like really interesting kits. Like one character has dual blades, and his skill too like raises a bar but it decreases HP every time you use this skill up to 55%. And then after that, it won't consume any more. But then if you fill up this bar and then like uses like skill again, he'll enter like a rage state mode where he does a lot of damage for a limited amount of time and stuff like that. So they're each character feels really different from one another. That mechanic is just exclusive to that character. And the gacha system in this one is pretty forgiving for the most part. Like it's kind of like, out of the gate, obviously it's a new game. The developers are trying to like get people on board. So of course they're gonna be generous at first. So like for example, you can get like your first 5-star character selectable within 3-10 rolls, and they'll give you like 30 pulls out the gate. So you can get like a 5-star of your choice off the bat. And then like there's other banners that like give you your selected character when you pull like 70 times. The weapon banner is guaranteed whatever you select. So like say you selected like the dual blades for this character, and you pull like, you know, a 5-star, it's always guaranteed to be that weapon and nothing else. So it's not like there's no like 50-50 on that. The limited time banner is like, it's a 70-30, meaning that like if you pull a 5-star off of that banner, there's a 70% chance it's going to be that the rate up character instead of 50-50, etc. So off the like compared to other gacha games that kind of try to do this, it's relatively more generous. But of course it is right now. Who knows how the currency economy and the pool economy is going to be in the long term, you know. But it has an interesting story to it that like it kind of intrigues me in that regard, and the English voice acting is actually pretty good too, like well done on that part. And it's, I think the main thing that like really holds back this game is, since it's like an indie developer, it's launched a lot of bugs. One of the big bugs that they recently fixed, it took like 2 days for them to fix it, was like people who logged into like the Google login couldn't log in because there's like some weird rate up, or not rate up, like a cap on it, like some sort of like login cap. So if people couldn't actually log into their Google accounts to play that game because there was like a login cap or rate cap or whatever So that was bad. Apparently they fixed it. There's other bugs. Bugs that, like, there's some stuttering, freezing for some people depending on the device. It is technically playable on a PC, but it's through the Google Play Games beta app on PC, which isn't great. You can't play it on any other emulator. So if you wanted to go to LD Player or Moomoo or BlueStacks, you can't play it on there because of its anti-cheat. Which sucks, you know, like because people like to go to those emulators to map, like, their controllers to it, which Google Play Games doesn't let you do that. You can play it, you can rebind it on keyboard on Google Play Games, but, you know, your mileage may vary because, like, my computer specs can brute force most of the bad technical aspects of it. But, you know, but for some other people, they have really bad problems on they try to play it on PC through that. It's technically a mess in terms of, like, just, you know, people have different problems of how to when running this game. But the game itself is, like, it's okay, but they really needed to, like, launch with, like, an official PC client with controller support for this type of game. Like, it's a very reactive action RPG with, like, you know, parries. perfectly timed dodges, etc. And that doesn't feel good to play on mobile touchscreen. Like, I played on keyboard on the Google Play Games thing, and that's been okay, but, you know, not the preferred way to play. I'd rather play this on, like, a nice PC client that's built well optimized on controller. That would have been my preferred way to play it. But
do most of these games have PC clients nowadays? Because I'm like, I'm trying to think, like, as someone who hasn't really been in this space, like, is that something that MiHoYoHoYoVerse kind of, like, pioneered? And I'm not saying was the first, but maybe the first to make it, like, expected versus games that just were purely mobile and played through an emulator.
They definitely didn't invent it, but they maybe pioneered, like, the popularity of that idea. I think more and more of these games do want, like, you know, are exploring options to get a official PC client, you know. Just the other day, like, the Blue Archive announced they were going to come to Steam at summer 2025, you know, and that's a game that, like, you know, it's fine for mobile for the type of game it is, but these... they want to expand their markets and try to get more and more people. Like, Madoka was originally announced on Steam, for Steam, and that'll come later. And you see more of these PC clients, either on their own or on Steam, pop up. Like, yeah, Wuthering Waves as its own PC client, but it can also be accessed through Epic Game Store. Another Eden has a PC client on Steam. Last Claudia also on Steam has a PC client. So, like, more and more of them are getting PC clients, whether it's on their own or through Steam or Epic Game Store, but rarely through Google Play Games, because Google Play Games is, like, an emulator, and it's not really a great emulator either. So I think if you want to be competitive these days, it's very preferable, especially if you're an action game on for these types of games, to get a PC client, because you're just demanding a lot of people to, like, play these games on a touchscreen. It doesn't feel great. Like, trying to play, like, Genshin Impact or Zenless Zone Zero, or especially Wuthering Waves. Like, Wuthering Waves, like, is not an enjoyable experience on touchscreen because of the type of action-packed gameplay that it has.
Do you know if they support, Bluetooth controllers or anything? But at the same time, I struggle to imagine people pulling out their phone and, like, whipping out the controller to play it.
Some do. Like, I know Wuthering Waves does. I'm sure the MiHoYo games do too as well. But I for Black Vegan, I don't think they support controllers. It's a case by case thing, but developers really strive to support them on that. And also, like, you know, it's graphically compromised too. Like, I know Infinity Nikki, the difference between, like, the PC version and the console versions over the, like, the mobile versions, like, it's just, like, night and day. Like, the mobile version just looks comparatively, like, awful compared to the console and PC versions of, like, Infinity when that first came out. So it's just, you know, I it's tough, you know, because you have to spend time and resources to make those games playable on PC
and indie studio and, you know, especially limited resources.
Yeah. No, it's rough, but that's what I've been, you know, working. I mean, not working at, but I mean, I've been kind of been checking out on my own spare time. I'll check out G-Generation Eternal, coming out in a few days. All of these games are on a temporary notice, okay? I'm not saying I'm going to play these forever. I'm just like, it's more of a curiosity thing because I'm always interested in, like, what the newest and hottest games look like in the space.
Well, that makes sense. And kind of see, like, all people inspiring each other back and forth. Of course, a lot of Hoyoverse, you know, and then a few others that have managed to stand out from the crowd, like Wuthering Waves, and kind of seeing where, you know, what ends up, you know, rises to the top versus what ends up faltering.
Yeah,
I'm seeing all the interesting ideas come through. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Cough, Square Enix, cough.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a hard, it's harsh out there, man. It's harsh out there.
Mm-hmm. And in a fairly completely other direction, before we get to the news here, we have a second topic here in our outline marked Degeneracy Corner, but this is marked for James's raiding experience in the new, I believe, 7.2 Savage tier. I haven't been following it directly, but I see him cropping up on Blue Sky talking about his prog and earnestly rooting for him, even though I don't understand what's going on. So detail it out for us, like the new raid tier was added in the patch update, and your experience progging that. And I assume you were ultimately successful, but I'm actually not sure.
Yeah, didn't quite get week one for a multitude of reasons. To be blunt, our scholar was having issues with her internet, and there was also some consistency issues with not just one specific person, but there was, without naming names, one specific person that probably was the bottleneck. But we did get week two. We did see the Enrage for the final fight week one, so we could have gotten it if it wasn't for... probably the scholar's internet issues, at least. But yeah, doing Final Fantasy raids week one is always fascinating because I'm a raid sicko. I did the latest ultimate raid. I cleared the latest ultimate raid. I would say that doing Savage raids week one is more difficult because that means you're doing them with the minimum gear that you can get for them, which would be the crafted gear. Which the difference between Savage and Ultimate raids in 14 is, like, the Ultimate raids are balanced around the fact that you'll have best in slot from the previous fights, whereas the Savage raids, they're kind of designed to get easier as you get more gear, and because of that, the DPS checks, the mitigation checks and whatnot are probably a little bit stricter when going through the Savage fights week one. Maybe not the first two fights, but definitely the last two fights. It's a situation where if you get, like, more than a single death and a damage down, if you do not know how to press your buttons and your team doesn't know how to press their buttons, and especially if you have a death right before a 2-minute burst window, that can cascade really quickly, and you won't be able to meet the DPS check, which... it's very exhilarating if you're in it for, like, the mastery of the game systems and whatnot.
So being tuned to be extremely, like, tight window challenging wise with the gear you're expected to have at the launch of the tier, but then as people slowly upgrade their gear and I assume also just learn the fight, kind of that, like, actual player skill and knowledge is improved as the fight is out. You might get someone who cleared it joining a group that didn't clear it to support them or has better gear in place so that the DPS window isn't so tight.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to say too much about it just because, I did obviously write up my impressions about patch 7.2 as it stands right now. And I feel like right now it's mostly just in a good spot for raiders. And that's kind of been the situation with Dawn Trail since launch. But in the next month and a half, we'll be getting stuff like Cosmic Exploration, which is casual content that really focuses in on crafters. So people that can level their crafters and people that are maxed out that can kind of veg out, just have a good time doing this sort of casual content. And then there's also Shades Triangle, which is really the big thing that I feel like most people are excited for. If you're not, even if you're not a raider, a lot of folks do love those exploration zone style style stuff. Like I know a bunch of people that haven't really been playing 14 for a while, but they're waiting for Shades Triangle to drop so they can get back into it. I don't know if Adam remembers this, but I was actually talking like after like a panel at GDC with Harper J, and they were talking about how they were actually pretty excited to get back in for that content too. So 7.2 gonna be a pretty good patch when all is said and done. It's already a great patch if you're a raider, because like, again, I'm not going to go into specific details, because in my 7.2 kind of impressions, I outright said that, to be blunt, talking about the nitty-gritty about raid tiers isn't really something that I feel like is within RPG Site's wheelhouse. It's a bit too esoteric. But for the last couple of years, I've been telling like Tony over at Nova Crystallis, it's like, hey, you know that I like do these raids like pretty early, if not week one, within the first like couple of weeks. If you want someone to like write about the raid tier, I would be willing to do so. So I'm actually going to, he actually took me up on that offer this time. So I'm going to write about the raid tier in depth for them in the next couple of days. All I will say is that pretty much everyone that has done the raid tier so far, which it's a very difficult tier, it's one of the hardest ones they've done, pretty much everyone, especially hardcore prog, I don't know how people on Party Finder are going to feel about it, because there's specific fights that feels like PF killers. But for people in statics, and especially people that did it hardcore week one or two like I did, pretty much everyone's under the same impression where this might be, if not the best raid tier they've ever done, the best raid tier they've done in a decade. It's really, really good.
I know this might not be the most appropriate way to quantify it because there's so many other factors, but when they have an update like this, like how many, this is me coming from someone who has only played like 20 hours of Final Fantasy XIV, like how many fights do they add in a group? Is it like 8? Is it 5? Is it 10? Because I know every single MMO
kind of has a
different cadence.
I didn't
even
know that you had even installed Final Fantasy XIV.
I played it like 8 years ago for like 20 hours.
Sure. Yeah.
I had a Thaumaturge? No, it's not the right word. I don't remember what the class was. Yeah, it wasn't even a final class.
Right, available on PC and PS5 Xbox Series.
Yeah, let me look up Final Fantasy XIV classes, and once I read it...
Thaumaturge is a class that turns into a black mage. So if you said Thaumaturge, you're probably right. You're probably playing Thaumaturge.
Mm-hmm.
Shout out Victor Strelsky.
Completely different game.
Yeah.
But yeah, how many fights do they add like per update? Like
so
this?
They have the normal mode fights, which are like the easy versions of the fights, and then they have 4 or 5 savage mode fights. I say 4 or 5 because the fourth fight of a tier is either going to be longer. So in this case, Howling Blade, which is the fourth fight of the cruiserweight tier, is a 14-minute encounter, and actually, the way that works is that in 14, you have stuff called door bosses and wall bosses. And usually for the fourth fight of a tier, the fight's either going to be a door boss, which means it's going to be 2 fights kind of split in half, and they're each going to be like 7.5, 8 minutes long. Or they're going to be a wall boss, where it's like one big fight with like 2 main phases. But the main difference between a door boss and a wall boss is that a door boss, you get a checkpoint, which means that once you clear the first fight, the door boss itself, then the second phase, you can just, whenever you wipe, you just start from the beginning of the second phase. Whereas a wall boss, it's like, in this case, there's a cutscene like about a minute long between phase 1 and phase 2 of Howling Blade's different fights, but it's one fight. Because if you wipe in the second phase, it brings you right back to the first phase. And it's very much, and I'm not the only person that said this, this tier, like I said, very difficult. Definitely one of the harder tiers they've done. And I'll just say this, the final fight in this tier very much feels like an ultimate in the way that's structured. it's not as hard as an ultimate, but it definitely feels like if you clear this fight week one and two, and now granted, anyone that's going to be doing hardcore prog probably already does ultimate fights, but if you somehow don't and you clear this fight within the first like 2 or 3 weeks, I'll tell you right now, you are ready to do ultimate raiding, because if you can clear this fight when the damage and mitigation checks are still pretty tight, Howling Blade is very much like 2/3, 3/4 of an ultimate fight in terms of difficulty. And well, difficulty early on, I'd actually say this was harder than Frew. Like this tier itself was harder than Frew. But in terms of the length, like Frew was 19 minutes long. Howling Blade with the cutscene was 14 and a half minutes long. So yeah, it's really good fight. The one thing that even if you aren't a 14 player, you might have seen on social media is people have been having a lot to say about Final Fantasy IX friendly monsters, particularly the Yan and the Gimme Cat. If you're not a 14 player, don't worry about it. It's a savage raid mechanic. The one thing I will say about the raid tier that is notable that isn't really a spoiler and isn't really something like I'm going to be talking about the entire raid series at Nova Crystallis. But one thing I can say is it has been a very, very long time since a 14 fight has had an honest to God ads phase. Like there have been encounters with ads before, but usually they've been either stationary or there's like a dance you have to do around them. Maybe you have to separate them. No, this time it's like a prolonged 3.5 minute long ads phase. The main tank and the second tank have to grab separate packs of ads and separate them, because if they get too close together, you'll give Deanna a damage boost. And if that happens, you might as well wipe there, because on a good day, a Yan will chunk like a third of your health with an auto attack, which is already pretty bad. If it gets the damage buff, it's going to just chew through your second tank and then proceed to slaughter every single ever person in that raid with headbutts, which is why you've been seeing a lot of people talking about that thing. Because if 14 players haven't had a reason to really learn their AoE rotations, especially in raids, they haven't had to learn about like how to manage a proper ads phase in a very long time, probably since Heavensward. So there's a lot of folks that have been struggling with the current, with having to learn that sort of tool set, which is good because the fact that the dev team felt like they could do that, they could have raids designed in a way that they really flex different sorts of skill sets that aren't just necessarily keeping up time, keeping up your rotation, and that sort of thing. It's like, it's made this raid tier feel very, very good. The difficulty curve has been very satisfying, and it's made me super, super excited for Shade's Triangle between this tier and some of the stuff they did with Chaotic Cloud of Darkness in last patch. It's like, okay, they're cooking. They're cooking. The raids, the fights for for Shade's Triangle, they're going to be incredible. I can't wait, especially if all the stuff they're doing with Phantom Jobs. So I'm 14. Is in a good state. A lot of folks that aren't raiders don't feel it quite yet, but I'm telling you, give it a month and a half, people are going to be saying this is probably one of the best patches that 14's ever gotten, because the main story's been very good, the raids have been incredible, and every indication is that the other stuff that's going to be added is going to be something special. So I'm feeling really good about 14 right now.
The way you described that fight, first of all, I have enough PTSD from those characters just from Final Fantasy IX, the island's closest to heaven and hell. I'm like, oh, not these bastards. And then also, the way you described the fight, it kind of reminds me a little bit, changing genres here a bit, of when they added Alatreon to Monster Hunter World, and they're like, your Ifrit Behemoth gear isn't going to work on this fight. You have to gear slightly differently. And some people took that challenge head on, and some people were like, oh, I don't know how to play any other way. So at least the way you described it, that's kind of the comparison that I was making in my head.
Actually, the islands closest to heaven and hell are Final Fantasy VIII, and those have random stuff on it. It's Vile Island.
What is the one in 9? Vile Island.
I had to look it up. I guess knew it wasn't.
I have to wait for that remaster. I'll have to wait for that remaster to come out and refresh my memory, because it's been 25 years or 30 years. But yeah, I remembered him from 9. And then cute, James did write up his... They are cute. James did write up his thoughts on 7.2 and Final Fantasy 14 up on RPG site, and it sounds like he's going to go even more in depth in the coming week for Nova Crystallis. So give that a read too once it goes online. With that, we'll go into news. Kind of an interesting, kind of varied week this week. A lot of the big, you know, megatons, so to speak, have already been dropped. A lot of some interesting indie things, a few kind of new studios and debut projects here. And of course, some we talked a little bit about the cards starting to be set down for summer stuff. And I know we're a bit early, but a few placements have already been decided. So starting out with just announcements, a few indie games here, or a couple. This first one is called Tomo Endless Blue. It is from a new developer, Onibi, O-N-I-B-I. And this is a monster catching raising game like Pokemon, only it has some procedural generation. It has voxel based like crafting. So like 3D Starbound is the way I think of it. And there's like, you know, Terraria. There's a lot of different points of comparisons you can make. It's got like a cute cell shaded sort of art style. One thing on this that I saw is they said, the game utilizes a combination of handcrafted content and bespoke procedural generation. And to me, I'm like, isn't that a little bit at odds? If it's procedural, it's not bespoke, because bespoke means it's like made to order, made by hand. But if it's procedural, it means it was just parameters kind of randomized in a sense. So I'm not 100% sure like what needle they're trying to thread there, but it is a combination of the two. And then there's a launch trailer for this game slated to release on PC in 2026. At first, I looked at this. I'm like, oh, this is an indie Pokemon, like with some crafting elements. Not anything too crazy, though. It does look pretty. However, the last bit of the trailer kind of has like a vibe jump where a character ends up being like mutilated and consumed by like some sort of evil entity. A very tonal whiplash there. So I'm not sure how they're going to thread that juxtaposition in the total game. But it seems fun. It seems charming. It seems kind of, I don't know, seems high budget. It looks pretty. And the trailer is pretty evocative in terms of its art style and how it's intended to run, even though it's more CG than, you know, gameplay.
Yeah. But, yeah. The thing that makes me wonder, like what the flow of the game is, because like, I think of Pal World when it comes to this game, because of the last
that's a good point, Kevin.
Bullet yeah. point there in their press release, like there's multiplayer, but it has offline single player, but also there's local network multiplayer, and then they call quote unquote distance server play, which is an interesting thing to how you phrase that. But they mentioned there's no limit on the number of players; it's as many as the player's device or server can support. And I'm like, how the fuck does this game work? You know, when I think about that, I don't know. That's weird. That's kind of like, all right, there's no player cap. So you can just have what 100 player, 200 player servers doing what? I don't know. So it's kind of
yeah. I just want to bring up. Just want to bring up Starbound. I haven't heard that game mentioned in so long. Yeah. I looked up when I bought that on Steam, and I bought it in December 2013. I still haven't played more than like 5 hours of it. Good decision. Good job. I think it was. I remember when I bought it, I was gonna wait for it to come to Vita, and that never happened. But yeah, I just haven't thought of it in so long.
You're still waiting for the Vita version too.
Yeah, of course. Like Type-0 HD.
Yes.
So obviously, we have the announcement trailer up on the site. We have the press release describing the game, and a bunch of introductory screenshots. So slated to release next year. Currently announced as PC only. Debut project for the new studio. And another indie, I think, debut project news. This one is an indie horror game called Neverway. So this is from Cold Blood. And my points of comparison here, I haven't played very many similar games, but it looks like, first of all, there's a lot of really decent talent on this from a lot of interesting places. It has music by Disaster Piece, who worked on Hyperlife Drifter, and it has pixel art from Pedro Medeiros, who worked on Celeste. So obviously some pretty good pedigree there. And then even though I haven't played it, when I just covering games, I look at this and it kind of reminds me of like that Yumi Nikke style horror indie like isometric game. Mm-hmm. It has like a monochromatic color scheme in terms of like, this is kind of probably a fossil point of comparison, but do you remember when you played the original Pokemon Red or Blue, but you put it in a GBC instead of a Game Boy? Every single town would have like a specific color.
Like Lavender Town would be lavender color.
Yeah, but it's monochrome per region per area. That's when I looked at the official announced trailer for Neverway here. That's kind of reminds me of, is that each kind of scene has a different tint to it, but monochrome within each scene. So obviously the pixel art looks really good. It looks like it has some kind of like visual novel-esque like story dialogue text reading in terms of piecing together, you know, what happened before you, things like that. It also blends some sort of sim elements. They didn't really come through in the trailer for me. The trailer is more exploration and combat, but they do talk about that in the press release. No release date, just slated for PC. Does have a Steam page, but just the initial announcement for a game that's currently in development. In terms of other news, we have a large number of trailers here. And I know, obviously, as we say frequently, podcast is not the best avenue to discuss these trailers, but we can at least talk about them in passing. So the biggest one here, probably, well, in terms of length, at least, is that we got a date for the Xbox Games Showcase and the Outer Worlds 2 Direct in June, obviously by publisher Xbox. This is going to be on June 8th, which is right around when it kind of always lands. So they've announced the date for a deep dive into Outer Worlds 2, which is, of course, the second kind of big first-person RPG from Obsidian this year, which is an interesting way that lined up. And obviously, under the Microsoft banner, one of their big, long-awaited RPGs for, you know, ever since that acquisition, and this game was announced like 4 years ago, this has kind of been when we're going to see it later this year. And we also, alongside the announcement of the June 8th date, IGN kind of have a 10-minute first exclusive look. They get these kind of frequently, of course, due to their, you know, their size and their connections. So it's just an 11-minute gameplay footage, kind of B-roll of a, I presume, early game quest in the game. It's been a while since I played Outer Worlds 1, so I don't really have the fresh, you know, short-term memory about things that are the same and different, but it does evoke the same vibe in terms of its UI and its just the gameplay feel. I remember Outer Worlds 1. Adam, I think you've played it more recently than I have. I always kind of struggled a little bit with that game in terms of itemization. It felt like it had a lot of stuff that you would pick up and just be kind of useless, specifically like food items and things like that, that didn't really feel like they had smart or well-implemented gameplay designed around them. And then in this gameplay video, they are picking up items left and right. So I'm like, oh, I wonder if they address this. Of course, I'm gleaning from a sliver of a snippet. So I have no idea, like, once you get time to actually see how these things are implemented in a long form game, what it means. But there's a lot of item pickups. There's obviously first person dialogue scenes. The dialogue scenes show very similar to what Outer Worlds 1 showed when it was initially presented back in, what, 2017, 18, whenever that was. Where you have a lot of options on a list. It'll tell you if there is a dialogue choice that you don't meet the prerequisites for. It looks like a lot of these are skill-based in terms of, like, there's an option here that you can't select, and you don't even read what it is. It just shows a big question mark because your medical skill isn't high enough or whatever. So that's always kind of cool to see in RPGs where you're like, I could have seen a different route here if my character was built differently. One thing that I thought was interesting in this gameplay is that all of the characters have, like, masks over their face. So I saw some comments saying, like, they're hiding the mocap of the facial features. And like that seems a little bit cynical, but I was like, oh, that is interesting that you don't obviously see your player's person because it's first person, but then like an NPC that you meet and the companion shown in the footage both have masks, so you can't see the extent of lip sync. Otherwise, it, like, the art style looks pleasing to me. It looks very much like RPG early game quest, a few puzzlings. You get like an X-ray visor that allows you to see like how electrical conduits are connected. There's some light puzzle elements there. So it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know how much we can glean from this little snippet, but it seems promising. It seems fine. See, there was a little bit of screen tearing in the gameplay footage, which I thought was a little bit unfortunate. So, but obviously still on dev. But yeah, we have a link to the, of course, credited to IGN, their first look, but we have it put up on RPGsite.net as well. So
the main thing with Outer Worlds 2 that I kind of hope for is the Outer Worlds 1, I think, kind of had like a good skeleton of a game, but I think it clearly like overscoped itself or underscoped itself in that like it was a Private Division game. I don't think it was ever meant to be a really big game, but then it kind of like
got marketed as that.
Right. And then it some of like the choice and consequence quest stuff didn't really pan out. Like, you know, it kind of all funneled itself into one direction. You know, it's a little bit thin, but, and I'm kind of hoping this game, even in their re-announcement trailer, they're like, this took three times as long to make. like, okay, maybe this is going to be more like fully fleshed, fully featured, fleshed out. So
my main takeaway from Outer Worlds 1, 5 years removed, is that the cities were dense, like the populated area was pretty dense. Some of the early planets you went to were dense. And then you got Mantis, which is like this big, uncolonized, uncivilized. It was basically the pulse of the game, to make a Final Fantasy 13 comparison. But it was like so empty, and all the enemy models were like reused and recolored, and there was like nothing to do there. And it felt like this was underbaked to heck. So I hope it's a little bit more even keeled. If not, I don't need it to really be bigger, just like more evenly paced than Outer Worlds 1. And of course, you can't glean that from an individual quest demo. Obviously, the Outer Worlds 1 had a very tongue-in-cheek, very like snarky vibe to it in terms of humor, in terms of how it presented itself. There's a little bit of that in this trailer, but not, it seems like it's toned down a little bit, but again, who knows how much you can extrapolate. Like, for instance, you're talking to this injured researcher in this base, and when you leave the conversation with her, she's like, I'll be here sitting in an ever-growing pool of my blood, because she's, you know, bleeding out. And it's like, oh, that's quippy, but in the vibe that Outer Worlds 1 was already quippy, so it's like kind of expected. It's not new.
I mean, that first trailer, you know, like, they're clearly,
I like that first trailer. Yeah, this
jokey, you know, that's what it is. So.
It's hard because, like, I think we should have some games that aren't trying to be like mega epic, deep, serious, too serious for me. But also, humor is very hard to land. Right. So if you have something that feels super cringe, then you're like, ugh, this is not what I wanted. So it's a hard thing to land, but obviously it's been in development a while, so it'll be interesting to see where exactly it compares with the first game on that.
I have a question about the Outer Worlds. I still haven't played much of the original. What's the deal with the Spacer's Choice Edition? I feel like when it came out, a lot of people were unhappy with it. So is that the one I should avoid?
All I heard about it is that they changed the lighting, and they obviously advertised it as like, we improved the lighting, but then it was like, lighting inside buildings is what I saw was like all messed up. Like, things were way too dark. Like, why does no one turn the lights on in here or what? And I don't know. That's all I saw, that they kind of just messed with the lighting, but didn't like test it properly.
It's like, okay, if you want a gold edition of the game that has the two DLCs included, it comes packaged with, you get this lighting update, whether you want it or not. And it felt like the lighting was just like universally applied, where they just moved some filters or shifted some sliders, and they're like, better lighting now. And you're like, but it's not better.
Wait, so I'm just curious. Outer Worlds, it's on Steam now. Remember, it wasn't on Steam originally. It was an Epic game.
Right.
Yeah, it was an Epic exclusive.
But I'm trying to remember. Okay, Outer Worlds is on Steam. That is not the Spacer's Choice. Oh, there's... Okay, yeah, so there's Outer Worlds is on Steam. It's $15. And then there's like the Spacer's Choice upgrade, which has the two DLCs and the upgrade bundle, but like, maybe don't get that upgrade. Just get the game, get the DLCs separate.
No, so from what I see, there's like, I own the Spacer's Choice Edition. I think it might have been in some Humble Bundle or something like that. So I was just, I don't own the base game with any DLC. So I don't know if, like, do I have to like buy the game to get the good lighting or something, like buy it again or something? But yeah. It's just confusing because there's a Spacer's Choice Edition upgrade. Yeah, probably.
A few other kind of simpler, shorter trailers for some other upcoming games. Of course, we're, I think, less than a week away for Lunar, the remastered collection. We got the story trailer just last week that we talked about very briefly. We have some more extended gameplay trailers, like 7-8 minutes apiece. So the story trailer showed a little bit of snippet of how like the battle animations look, how the exploration looked. Of course, these gameplay trailers just show it, you know, at length. So it gives you exactly how the game looks. And I've already seen some people say that this is very much more Grandia HD coded rather than like Suikoden or Octopath or anything like that, which, depending on your point of view, is a good thing or not so good thing. But some extended trailers for that. I know we have a few people that are interested in talking about that next week.
I saw someone mention, I have not played the original Lunars, but I saw someone mention that it looks like some of the working designs jokes are still in, which some people might be happy about and some people might not be happy about. So
we got a few more character trailers for two upcoming games. We've been talking about these at a regular basis. So Elden Ring Nightreign, of course, releases at the end of May. It's going over its different character classes. We talked about the one that was the Archer, which I'm forgetting what it was. Iron Eye, that's it. And this new one is the Duchess, who is a basically, as far as I can tell, an evasion tank. Was this character available to play like in the preview, Josh?
No, I don't believe so.
Gotcha. So the trailer here is, it's only a minute, so it's just a snippet. It talks about, you know, a skill that evasion uses a one-handed weapon, looks like an extended dagger. So focusing on avoiding damage rather than taking damage, dodging, actually, critical hits, things like that.
It might have been. I've been looking at it again. I think the Duchess was there as like the thief character. Yeah, I think the Duchess was there.
Okay.
Yeah. It's been a while. I'm like already forgetting like the classes that were in it. I'm pretty sure it wasn't.
Mm-hmm. In Alex's preview, he says it reminds him of like the Black Knives from Elden Ring. Clair Obscur Expedition 33, of course, releasing in about 2 weeks at the end of the month. Final character trailer, Monoko. So some sort of like golem character. Uses like a, it looks like kind of, again, these character trailers for Expedition 33 are more flavor than gameplay primers, but feels like the party's like Blue Mage has like a bestial wheel that they can use, but it doesn't really talk about how it's used. I'm just trying to glean from the gameplay footage here. And of course, we'll be covering this game once it releases in a few weeks. But I think that makes it up to 5 playable characters, each with their own individual trailer. And that's what's on the box art. So we have all 5 of those up on the site as they were released over the last month. Mandragora, Whispers of the Witch Tree, of course, another game releasing in under a week, just 5 days from the time of recording. They've been doing a lot of these big deep dives for the RPG mechanics of these games. These ones, the publisher here is truly trying to, in my opinion, platform this game as the Vania in Metroidvania in terms of having like progression and character building and build craft and lots of variety and skills and classes. And this one, we talked about the skill tree a week or two ago. This one focuses on the classes. It talks about how you can, as they've been kind of hammering in all their trailers, you're not locked into a single class. There's hybrid builds, there's mixing and matching, there's refunding, you can respec at different points. The more I see this game, the more interested I am in it. I don't know how I'm going to squeeze it in, but
the advertising is working. The advertising blitz is working. Then
I think for me, I just really like. I don't think I cared too much about the vibe or the theme, but when they give me all these like nitty gritty stuff, mm-hmm. I'm like, oh, this is kind of what I want to see. I'm a nerd at heart.
There you go.
So I'm interested, and I believe this is their debut project as well, Primal Game Studio. It's the only one they've got listed on Steam, so I believe so. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, we've seen games. It's hard to tell from marketing how it holds itself for, you know, a 20, 30-hour game. But there's a demo available, and there has been for a while, so maybe I'll try that out. Moonlighter 2, this was announced, I believe, at a Nintendo Direct earlier this year. Looks very similar in like scope and theme to the original Moonlighter, with the main difference being the new like isometric 3D art style rather than the top-down pixel art style. Gameplay trailer, it really kind of seems like more Moonlighter, which is not a bad thing, because I don't think anyone really expected a sequel. But obviously there's dungeon crawling aspects, but also a big, you know, shop-owning, you know, aspect to it here. So it shows some of the platforming. It shows some of the shop management stuff. It's Moonlighter. So if you play the original, I don't think anything in this trailer was super surprising. But I know a lot of people that are interested and excited for this one as well. Currently slated just to release later this year. No specific date just yet. Looks like a summer was the window that was previously communicated. Sacrifier. This is one that's been an indie project that's been kind of shown off for several years now. I guess it was first announced like in 2021, so it's been a while. They originally slated maybe it comes out this year. They've announced that it will release in Q1 next year. This is the one that's been most compared to, I think, like classic Star Ocean in terms of how the battles are, like the perspective you have there, how the abilities work and things like that. So alongside the announcement of the launch window, there's a short little gameplay trailer. But it's a few bosses that we haven't seen before. But again, it's a little too short, I think, to glean much out of the.
They've had Steam demos as well, and I think they've gotten feedback on that. So I think that's probably what's driving this delay again. Is like, hey, they want to, polish up the game based on the feedback that they got based on the demos of that game. Because I don't think like people are kind of iffy about it, from what I recall.
Mm-hmm. It has kind of like that faux HD2D. Of course, HD2D is just a branding name for Square Enix titles. But it reminds me actually kind of like Hyper Light Drifter in terms of just how the art looks. Of course, yeah, a different perspective, though.
I can see that.
Adam, what was that roguelike that you played?
Star Renegades?
Looks like that. Yeah, it looks like Star Renegades too. I wish I had more of the vocabulary to describe, like, no, the pixels look like this rather than this. But at the very least, I can say it reminds me of these other games. So I think it looks pretty, but yeah, apparently they've gotten some feedback in the demos that needed some tuning. But about a year out for that one. And then we'll do... we have a new trailer for Konami Date. Sorry, No Sleep for Konami Date. I'm stammering with this. I apologize. No Sleep for Konami Date from AI the Somnium Files. This was just announced, of course, a few weeks ago.
A long time ago.
Yeah. I'll be honest. I didn't watch these two trailers back to back, and I don't really know the universe, but I'm like, I think this is a lot of the same like story beats that we saw in the announcement trailer, but maybe extended a little further. So I'm not sure
how that's nothing too revolutionary. It's just kind of the story setup of it. Mm-hmm.
It has a bit more than what was shown in the first direct, and I think the new trailer is probably Switch 2 or PC footage. I think one of them, which I linked, is PC footage, if I remember correctly, because the original was it was just revealed in the Nintendo Switch 1 direct. Like you had some games which are this is coming to Switch 1 and some other platforms, or just Switch 1 and nothing else. And then 5 days later, it's also on Switch 2. Like that happened with this game as well. And then, you know, like what Josh brought up, like the thing with the physical and the pricing and all that. So now it's been confirmed that the physical for this one is a game key card, which means it just has a license on cartridge. Yeah. And when they announced, like before that, it's a budget price game for like $40 US and the physical was going to be $50. I thought, okay, like makes sense, cartridge cost. But for this, they're charging $50 even for the key card version. So you're literally just paying $10.
Yeah, that's bullshit. Game. Yeah. I can understand like the issue of it's like for Switch 2, like if they were gonna get an actual cartridge, that shit's more expensive. So it being $50 for a physical there, that makes sense. GameCube card, it's like, come on. It's like I'm a bit lenient because I'm sure that the Switch 2 cards are even more expensive than the Switch 1 cards were, because they have to have like a higher bandwidth, but it's like you can't have both. You can't have both.
Oh, and there's one more thing. We don't like know if there's going to be an upgrade path for this, because this isn't listed as a Nintendo Switch 2 edition. It's just like, as far as I checked on the eShop, it's just there. So there might not be an upgrade. There might be an upgrade. Who knows? This is like the George Costanza answering machine thing now for most of these games.
Yeah. The physical pricing, the upcharge just sucks because of how GameCube now factored the equation.
It sucks because I would actually love to get this on Switch 2, because it's like I played the second one on Steam Deck, but it's like Switch 2, it'll be 1080p in handheld mode. You know it's going to be native 1080p, so...
Oh, wow. You would hope, hopefully. I mean, that's nothing is guaranteed. Nothing is guaranteed.
So, and obviously not launching alongside Switch 2, but late July 25th. A few other updates for existing games. This one's kind of interesting, this first one here. Persona 3 Reload, obviously released in February of last year, now has a playable demo that does have progression carryover on consoles and PC, so on all platforms. So obviously good for people that have, you know, maybe are new to Persona or are haven't been interested in previously. And I think Atlas has been doing better about having carryover demos with unlaunched games, but sometimes they just come in late like this.
Yeah, still, they did like with SMT5 Vengeance as well, like the delayed demo. Like, is it too much to ask to like have it out before the game releases instead of like the other way around?
Mm-hmm. Having a demo available is good news, regardless of when it comes out. But it's like, I think, you know, this is one of those things where it's like, I'm not a producer, but, and I don't want to really say that, but I would imagine that like getting it out when your game is in the zeitgeist, it's, you know, it's new, it's in the top of people's minds. Hey, there's a demo playable. I just feel like that would get you the most return, your most bang in your
buck. I just think about Dynasty Warriors Origins of like, hey, you know what? They kind of did it right. They released it out before the game came out, like, you know, how it normally should be. And there's a lot of interest generated because of that demo alone, and made the game a massive success.
Like, same thing with that seems crazy. Same thing Koei Tecmo did with Atelier Yumiya.
That doesn't seem obviously crazy.
Obviously, you know, the best it's sort of the thing where it's like the best time to release a demo is before a game comes out. The second best time is, you know, now. And obviously not every game, not every type of game is, I'm trying, you know, you can see here, I'm not trying to be absolutist. Not every game is suited to a demo, but, you know, Atlas has already proven that it works well for their, titles.
They did it for Metaphor, and it worked out.
Yeah.
I think with Persona 3, like, they knew people were just going to buy it, and it was also in Game Pass, so they got what they could at that time. And this is probably let's see if we can get more people to buy the game now. Like, it's been, what, a year and a half or something?
Is it also Game Pass? I wonder.
I think Adam posted about this on Blue Sky. It's like there were some people who were like, why would you do a demo now? And he brought up a good point. It's like, do people like think games just vanish after like the launch window or something? This is a good way to get people to, like, people, you know.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of people think that, unfortunately.
Why? Yeah.
Yeah. So
it's good to be able to know that, you know, games don't disappear the minute they're launched. Yeah. But, you know, obviously that's where the hype, that's, you know, all these game releases, their sales are all so front loaded. So it's kind of like that's the reality. Did you have one more thing to say, Mikhail? Sorry.
No. Just that I kind of like, I'm glad there is a demo now so that people can try it and all. But having a demo whenever it is, even if it's late, is still better than no demo. But I mean, they do demos pre-release, they do demos after release, so they see how it affects their sales. We'll see what happens with their next game, because like Raidu Remastered does not have a demo announced or anything, and I don't know if that's something.
I really hope that does get a demo, so at least, you know, people can get interested in like what right, because I think a lot of people are like still kind of iffy about it. I don't know, man. I just. You know what? Back then, demos came out before the game released, okay? That's where I'm coming from.
Yeah, we got CDs in the mail in our magazine.
Yeah, that was awesome. Yeah, we got a fucking official PSM, PlayStation Magazine. There was a demo disc. Life was fan-fucking-tastic.
And we would play those demos because we were too poor to buy.
Exactly. I played the shit out of that Dynasty Warriors 3 demo. Oh my god, it was the best thing ever.
Shareware titles on DOS. I played the first episode in 3D like a million times before I ever bought the game to play the later episodes.
I didn't even know there was more to the game than like that, and for Jazz Jackrabbit, I played it on DOS. I thought that was the whole game.
We're a bunch of fossils.
Okay. Oh my god.
So speaking of Raidu, Adam, maybe I'll help you, have you help me explain this, this kind of, obviously the game was just very recently announced, very recently followed up with the Switch 2 version. Atlas also announced a thing called the Summoner's Guild, where you can sign up for something in terms of being excited for the upcoming release. To me, it feels like a newsletter, but I don't know, like, if there was more details than that, like devil in the details sort of thing. What is the Summoner's Guild?
I mean, it pretty much is just a newsletter in the in a wrapping of it's our online fan club. If you sign up, you get like the first chapter of the Raidu Kuzunoha manga for free.
You can, is this like a new manga or an existing one?
I actually don't know.
It's an existing, it's an old manga. It's getting localized for the first time.
Neat.
And they haven't said anything else though about what you get for signing up other than getting marketing emails. So have fun with that.
Versus the Lone Marabito, which is, that is an older manga. So, yeah, I mean, that, like, there's a lot of, like, Japanese games that kind of, like, have, like, manga spin-offs and side stories that are, like, localized, are not localized, published there in manga.
I saw that the Kingdom Hearts 3 manga ended recently.
Yeah.
I didn't know there was a Kingdom Hearts 3 manga.
Yeah.
So it's cool that they're actually going back to, like, old, like, materials like that they created way back when, and actually, you know, going through the effort of like of localizing them in multiple languages, not just English but also French, Italian, German, Brazilian, Portuguese, Spanish, and Latin American Spanish. Like, that's a massive effort, like way more than I would have fucking expected for their re-release of Raidu, which is cool. You know, I definitely support and encourage.
Speaking of being a fossil, it still feels so weird to me just how big Atlas has gotten. When back in the day, it's like they were just the most niche shit. And now it's like
their index days. Oh man, that was
SMD1 on iOS, man. Remember that?
Yeah, and then waiting forever for Atlas games to come out here. Yeah, to just feels.
When did the first Raidu come out? 2006.
It was
shortly before the PlayStation 3, I think. And then, like, remember how Atlas released,
yeah, 2006.
Like, yeah, Atlas released a couple of PS2 games after the PS3 was out.
Yeah, like
yeah, this it came out in March 2006. October 2006 in North America. March in Japan, yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't Persona 4, like, after this?
Well, Rido 2, for sure. So, yeah. There's a handful of them.
And even then, like, we're talking about PS2 days, which is still, you know, not too long ago when you think about, like, how the turnover times for PS1 games, Atlas games, like. It just, well, you know.
PS2 had incredible legs, like, for the first, like, 4 or 5 years of the PS3, because primarily of Japanese studios just releasing, not even, like, cross-release, like, exclusively on PS2. Cross-gen, it existed, but it wasn't ubiquitous and during that specific gen changeover. So, yeah, Atlas released a bunch of games. You know, Persona 2, December 2008. So PS3 had been out for a couple of years at that point.
Back in our day, you know. it's always weird, especially from this point in time, to look back on it. It's like, man, we have it so good these days, and people still complain.
Well, we talked about this a little bit with, like, tweaking and fixing bugs during the HD remaster. Like, before, you just lived with them.
Yeah.
We're literally getting Falcom days of games day and date. It's like crazy.
Yeah, the final barrier.
Tired of us listening to how old we are.
Okay, look, the final impenetrable barrier that we have to cross is somehow convincing VanillaWare to get their titles on PC.
Yep, I was actually about to say, we need to get Idea Factory to start doing day and date, and, like, actually they are.
I know VanillaWare is like, PC. We're not even going to make a game unless you guarantee us that's not coming to PC. That's where we're at with VanillaWare.
God. Oh. Well, the good news is I'm sure that after the success of Unicorn Overlord, the next time that Sega Atlas funds their project, it's like, okay, you'll have unlimited budget. You have to release it on PC.
They're like, no, we won't take your money. We'd rather do it off of our life savings.
I don't know why they don't, like, what's stopping Sega from, like, getting it ported through some external partner? Because remember when Yakuza games were getting done by, like, Qlock, and there was an Australian studio that used to do that, and when that happened, then finally, I think with Yakuza 7 or Yakuza Like a Dragon, that's the one they did internally on PC. But before that, it was all, like, ported by different studios. Like, Valkyrie,
because the Delaware is saying no. They're like, they're not playing ball. They're like, nah, good.
Yeah, they don't they don't want to disrespect the VanillaWare leadership, even though it's, like, a stupid situation to be in.
Yeah, but Kamitani is like, you know what? I'd rather have go negative bank balance than put it on PC and let anyone else port it. I don't know how many more years, if ever, we're going to get on that. It feels like the multiple things that used to be that were deemed impossible are just happening these days. But that one thing with VanillaWare and PC, man.
You can tell that it's, like, ideological, like, legitimately.
Yeah. It's on record that it is.
You know, you've been doing this a while when it's like, I remember when Final Fantasy 13 coming to PC was like a megaton, and now it's like, of course it did, right? Of course. this next update is very, very strange. A few people shared this and was just like, what is this? So, two games we have talked about in the past on this podcast, Vampire Survivors and Saga Emerald Beyond, now have a collaboration DLC called Emerald Diorama. What?
Saga Emerald Beyond and Vampire Survivors together at last.
the developer of Vampire Survivors game, Pinnacle, decided to come out with this Saga sicko shit alongside the release of this free expansion to Vampire Survivors. And he's like, I'm declaring it to the world right now. The reason this happens is because I'm a massive Saga sicko, and I love Unlimited Saga. We're like, all right, dude. And he's like, the only reason I did this is because Saga Emerald Beyond was the most recent Saga games, but they're all fucking fantastic games, and Unlimited Saga is awesome. And we're like, all right. But it's awesome. Like, honestly, this is, like, one of the most out of nowhere collaborations that just like it, there was no teaser, no marketing for it. It's like it's boom right there. Like what the f-? Like once I saw, like what is going on? What the hell? This basically brings like all the playable characters from Saga Emerald Beyond into Vampire Survivors. It adds new mechanics to it. Like they have the glimmer system from Saga in this game now, and it's awesome that the way it works. We're basically, let me make sure I describe this correctly. You get a weapon with a sparkable or glimmerable or whatever skill on it. It has a very low chance to glimmer, and once it glimmers, you get a light bulb and a zoom in that you got it, and it does a big fancy move. And then from then on, you can just randomly do that whenever the weapon attacks. And that's just part of the update for free with this. It has, you know, Mido, Diva number 5, the twin, not twins, the duo protagonists, Sugnus, the vampire, and even Mr. S from the Saga series as a playable character. There's like, you know, I saw Screech as like the final emperor as like unlockable. People have to read this like whole blog thing, but there's a blog post on the Vampire Survivors Steam page of like the reason of why this happened, how this happened, why it's free. And I love the reason of why it's free, as explained by developer Pinocchio on this. Go for it, James.
It's literally like, it seems like the whole reason this happened is that he is such a Saga freak. He wanted an excuse to learn more about Emerald Beyond when it was like in development. And because of all the legal red tape, it didn't come out until now. And the reason it's free, it's like he wanted to release it before like this game's like, I guess like 2 years old or some shit.
Yeah, it's basically paperwork. Like, I don't want to deal with the paperwork. They don't want to deal with paperwork. So we're just going to release it for free, because if there was money involved, it had a lot more paperwork and it'd be further delayed. You know, which is like, it's, that's so, I love it. I love it.
Unironically, cool. We should reach out and see if we can interview him about this, because sounds really cool.
That, I had 10,000%. That'd be amazing.
That can be arranged.
Yeah, that'd be amazing. So yeah, I mean, it's there for free. If you have Vampire Survivors, boot it up and you can play it all right away, you know. Even more of a reason why Vampire Survivors is a fucking awesome game.
I have not played Vampire Survivors yet, but between the Castlevania DLC pack and this, it's like, fuck, I need to.
Yeah, it's hard because Punkle has like, he set the standard for like, I guess what do you call the Survivor subgenre now, and it's so
people
hard
call
to
them,
like
bullet heaven games.
Yeah, and it's so like, it's hard to like still compare to Vampire Survivors because Punkle like released this game at a very, very, very cheap price and has expansions that are all very affordable on top of that cheap price, along with just like big, massive collaboration expansions that are all just released for free. And he's like, yep, I do it for the love of the game, man. And it continually adds stuff to it, new weapons, new evolutions, new stages. And it's just like, it's such an incredible project that's like, and I'm so glad that like Punkle is like, is a steward for all this, has like was able to like kind of arrange all of this in a way that's thoughtful and in a way that's like it's brimming with passion and it should show. It's incredible, honestly.
And that covers us just before
moving ahead, updated the game a few days ago to finally add the cross save account system, which was like in beta for ages. And it was like initially just in a Steam branch, and then they added it to the beta on iOS, which I used to access that. And then they finally brought it to Xbox now, and it's coming soon to Nintendo Switch. But apparently there's some legal drama with the PlayStation version cross-save, which like the dev mentioned on like Twitter, saying that due to some legal stuff and some information which PlayStation requires or something like that, they can't launch it anytime soon on PlayStation, which is like, I immediately just deleted that version because if there's cross save on everything else, I don't need this version. So yeah, if you've been waiting for cross save in Vampire Survivors, it's finally on Xbox, mobile, and Steam, coming to Switch soon.
And Sony continues to make everyone's lives harder with its like very restrictive way it does cross saving.
Yeah. Somehow level 5 does that, though.
It kind of gleans, like, the things we sort of take for granted. We're like, yeah, you should release on everything and have cross-progression, but, you know, having to work with every individual platform holder and what their requirements are, and, you know, the paperwork we talked about, pricing, price parity, all that stuff, kind of goes, you know, takes for granted. So good on them for being open about it in their newsletters about saying, you know, where the holdup are and what they're trying to do to fix it.
I was looking at, like, okay, so think about this. Vampire Survivors has two original expansions, you know, the Legacy of the Moonspell, Tides of the Fiskari, but then it collaborated with, you know, as we mentioned, Emerald Beyond, Castlevania, also Among Us. I remember that trade. I was like, what the fuck is going on? And then they also collaborated with Contra. Like, this this game is just, it's all over the place, man. It's fucking wild out there.
You know what happened with when they did Contra? Everyone was like, why are you doing this as your Konami IP? Just do Castlevania. And the Contra DLC was fantastic. And the Among Us thing was also fantastic. And when they did, like, Castlevania, everyone thought, okay, this is the finale for the game. Like, it makes sense, right? Now suddenly Saga, Emerald Beyond, like, there's, like, I don't think anyone can predict what's going to happen next.
I have no
idea. Who knows? They might do some Kingdom Hearts shit soon. Like, we have absolutely idea.
Look, I bet you it's going to have a Nier Automata DLC at some point or expansion.
That would be good.
I feel like it's too, like, obvious, I guess.
Yeah.
Fuck. I feel like it's going to happen.
Last couple updates we have are some upcoming dates. Here, this game released in China last year, Where Winds Meet. It has a closed beta coming out on, May 16th. And it will release worldwide sometime in later 2025. I forget. This is an open world game. I forget if it's like Rise of the Ronin or... I'm trying to remember, like, what was the analog for this game.
Not really. I mean, I played a beta of this before as well sometime last year. I didn't know it actually came into full release in China last December. But it's like an open world game where it kind of is a Rise of the Ronin, where you can, like, there's definitely settlements, but there's, like, all these, like, kind of wuxia style aesthetics. Like the closest analog we have here on the podcast is, like, what was the name of that one game, Adam? The one that we really liked, the side scroller 2D RPG esque one, the learning all the
martial Wandering arts. Sword.
Wandering Sword. It definitely has that aesthetic of, like, you know, you learn different schools of martial arts and have different weapons and stuff like that, but it's obviously more of like an action RPG style. And the weird thing about it is, like, I don't know if they're releasing this as a free-to-play game, but it definitely has a progression of, like, a free-to-play game where you definitely have a stamina bar for, like, activities that you unlock later on, and there's, like, an account level that, like, as you do activities in the world, your account level will level up, and you get like, rewards, and you use that along with, like, materials you gather in the world to, like, upgrade, like, your weapon or your martial arts skills forth.
I remember I played the alpha for this, like, a while back, and I was pretty, like, the gameplay, I was like, yeah, this is good, but the moment I saw the progression stuff, I was like, maybe not.
It's kind of, that's the weird thing about it. It's like, I'm sure this is a cool game, but I just, you know, you know that progression, that structure, and, like, you're either okay with it or you're not. Like, you know, when it comes to, like, free-to-play-esque progression systems of, like, having account level and a stamina, you know,
it's like, I'm on record where it's like, I've always been kind of icky about, like, free-to-play games in particular because of the progression and how that stuff is designed, and I'm on record where it's like, I tried to, like, get over it with Honkai Star Rail, and that was the game that broke me, where it's like, man, I would love this game if it was a full price game that I could just, or like a subscription game that I could just play that way instead of have constantly feeling like I'm in a casino because I am in a casino.
You know what? I like the Vampire Survivor style. You have a base game and you have expansions to it, and they're all, you know, fully featured.
More games should do that.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy, and they're all super affordable as well.
So while we were talking about this game, I went to the Reddit page just to learn a little bit. A few people, like, in January when it was out in China. Like, what sort of game is this? It's free to play, single player MMO with like a multiplayer component. The person compares it to Genshin Impact, but also it's someone's like, there is a staggering number of quests. It has even more than in Ubisoft's canned games. Of course, he's speaking from a place of, you know, not thinking very highly of those. Shared an image of like one of the continents in this game, and it's just littered with icons everywhere.
Oh god,
there's plenty to do if you have looked into it. But yeah, single player, free to play. They're describing it as an MMO.
No, if it's single player, if it has like a, if I can pay a monthly fee to basically not have to worry about stamina, maybe I'd play it.
I mean,
who knows if they'll change the monetization for global or anything like that.
I'd have to really be into the gameplay, because the image that Brian shared is like a map with all the icons of like all the like the I assume quests and stuff in the game, which is like a full. It's just the icon, like the whole map and like the surrounding islands around that map is filled to the brim with diamond
literally hundreds of icons.
I'm like, oh, that sounds not great. That's the last thing I want to see. Like, I'm thinking about like, man, I feel like I'm getting open world fatigue, but like, I really like Xenoblade X is still doing it. And then you see this, I'm like, oh no.
Not to mention, there's so many super long games coming out like in the next couple of weeks. Like, Blue Prince just came out. Apparently, that's a puzzle game that's 100+ hours long. I don't fucking know how, but it's like it's a thing. And what I can say again from like what I've previewed of 100 line, that's a big game. That's a big game.
The interviews that have come out today, they have like 100 endings, and none of them are like supposedly like filler feeling endings. I'm like, and I don't know exactly what the requirements are for them, or whether it's just like, you know. But that just like that on its face, it's like, man, that sounds like probably longer than anyone expected.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, that's the vibe I had.
I don't know, man. I don't. Maybe when this game fully comes out, Wyrmwind's Meet, I'll give it a shot. But I'm still very, very. I'm not the most excited for them. But when I first saw this game, I was like, oh, this looks cool. But now knowing about the structure and the way that like progression works in that game and getting hands on, and I'm like, I don't know if it's that cool.
And then this last one, it's surprising to finally have a date for this. It's a game that's been long in development. We've talked about it in several contexts. This is Inazuma 11 Victory Road. It has got a date releasing worldwide for every console and PC, including Switch 2 and Xbox, recently added, on August 21st. So this is like the forever Inazuma 11 game, is the way I've seen it described. Josh, I saw you like sharing some thoughts on this in terms of like what this game could potentially be, or at least what it's platforming itself as.
Yeah, so the big thing about like the, when you said that the platforms, is they added this, as you said, Switch 2 and Xbox Series on the platforms. It's no longer coming to mobile, that those versions have been axed.
Right.
I think that makes sense because of the scope of this game. I don't know how you fit it onto mobile. But I was describing this to a friend earlier of like what this, like, because you were talking about long trailers earlier with an 11 minute thing for Outer Worlds 2. This final specs trailer for this is 19 minutes long. And it's just talking about the game's features and what it has. And going through that, like the nitty gritty of all that is, you know, kind of too much, but it has like a very, very brief overview. Inazuma 11, it's basically anime soccer or football, you know, for international listeners out there. And it's very over the top, you know, anime ass powers of like you summoning like a fucking god to like do your special shot or something, or like fusing with like a spirit animal to go into special form and, you know, doing anime ass shit with in football or soccer. And so I talked about this in, you know, when I tried out the open beta on it and in several contexts and whatnot. I'm not like, I'm very much like an Inazuma 11 fan, like newbie fan. Like, I'm interested because of what I played of Victory Road's open beta, but I never got hands on with any of the other Inazuma 11 games. But I'm very open to the idea of getting into it. And so the way that they describe this, like in the trailer for this final specs, like they already mentioned this before, but we didn't know exactly how they were going to do this. Like the Chronicle mode, for example, is it literally contains like all the stories of the previous Inazuma 11 games. And this franchise has gone on for like over a decade now. I think, well, maybe 2 decades. So it's like,
I mean, this game itself has been in development for 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been in dev hell. So it has that Chronicle mode. It has a fully featured original story mode that has like open, not open world, but open zone segments that like you can run around it and take side quests and stuff, along with like obviously building your team and going to tournaments and rising to the top. They have like an Animal Crossing-esque mode. I'm going to almost say verbatim like how I describe this game to a friend, because this is the best way I can describe it to like people who don't know. I described it as like this game, Inazuma 11 Victory Road, is like Super Smash Bros. Ultimate, but like on 1,000 times steroids. They even mentioned it in the trailer, but it has 5,200 characters. And this is from every single past, like, almost every single past like Inazuma 11 game like that was playable, whether you were like, they were an opposing team or like the main team or any of the side teams or whatever, all those rosters, they're all in this game. And you go through this Chronicle mode that covers every single game in that series. I'll get into this a little bit, where like this game technically has a gacha system, but there's no like paid currency that you're paying into to roll them. Basically, in this Chronicle mode, it's divided up with like these nodes, and like I guess you play them and gain like some sort of resource to do 10 rolls of like characters in that specific node. So let's say I'm like in the first game, there's like a node and it has like a roster from the first game. You can gain a resource to like pull into that, to those roster of characters to like obtain for you to play in the other modes of the game. They have like, I guess, rarities, I guess. I'm not exactly sure how it works in this game, but it's better than like gaining like a resource and pulling into like a pool of like 5,000 plus characters and hoping to get like, you know, this Inazuma 11 character that you like, for example. So that's why they divided it up, but there's no like paid aspect, real life money aspect for that microtransaction. Like the only thing that you're paying into is like the like access to the base game, obviously, or a deluxe edition for early access, like 3-day early access. Anyway, the other thing that like this game is also pushing is like they brought back every single quirk from the past games, and I equated this to Pokemon. Think of like Ina's, like imagine if there was a Pokemon game that had every generation of Pokemon, every Pokemon in that generation, and every gimmick Pokemon has ever done, whether it's like Gigantamax or Mega Evolution, all those gimmicks all in the same game. That is this game. And it has, and imagine that Pokemon game had a mode where it retold all of the previous Pokemon game stories in a mode, you know, and you're compiling, you know, a team of like, you know, all your favorite Pokemon to like, you know, deploy in battle. And stuff. This is kind of that game. And this is alongside a full original story mode that's separate from that Chronicle mode. This has like online multiplayer that has multiple modes. There's like a ranked match, a tournament mode, even like a 2v2 mode. So you can go co-op with a friend. There's like an Animal Crossing mode. You need to like skim through this fucking 19-minute trailer if you guys are interested at all. Like it's bonkers. It's a fucking insane game that, as Adam mentioned, has been in development hell for almost a decade. This game, I was looking through like the development history of this game, and there was an Inazuma 11 game called Inazuma 11 or Eris that I guess it grew in scope to the point that like they kept pushing that game back and then canceled it and then renamed it to like Path of Heroes or something, and then they kept on feature creeping that game. And then eventually renamed that game to Victory Road. And that was all in the span of like fucking 5 to 6 years. And before we even get to like the starting point of this current Inazuma 11 game's development. The game, as they mentioned in the presentation for this, does not have a physical release. It's only going to be digital release. $70 for the standard edition, $80 for the deluxe edition, and that has like the 3-day early access. They shared like a roadmap where they're gonna like add even more content to the game, like in September. Did you mention this game was coming out August 21st worldwide? I forgot. I don't even remember. And then, what do you call this? Yeah, they're gonna keep on adding content throughout September and November. And they're also like holding official tournaments for this. And basically, it's a giga video game. They even mentioned that the developers don't even know how long it'll take to beat this game. They're like, it's so feature packed. We don't even know how long it's gonna take to like for people to like actually beat this game. You know, like, okay, great, awesome. So, I definitely want to play it. I don't think I would want to review it. I would feel like I'd have no time at all. But I definitely want to play it and like enjoy it and like, you know, try to learn more about Inazuma 11 through it. The weird part about this game too is since it has sort of like a gacha system for acquiring characters, on the site there's, you know how in gacha games there are banners for characters, and like when there's a character banner, there's like a rate up on them. Say like, you know, this new Genshin character has like an increased rate, like a 70% chance to like be the character that you pull when you get a 5-star to pull. It has like maybe an increased percentage chance, just to emphasize that like, hey, you know, you might be able to get this character more likely than the other characters. For Inazuma 11 Victory Road, there are platform specific bonuses where the Switch and Switch 1 and Switch 2 and the PlayStation consoles and the Xbox consoles and the Steam release all have different 3 rate up characters on them. All the characters in the game are still going to be, you know, like the like content parity between all of them, but there's different rate ups on each of the different platform holders in this game. And I like how they mentioned that, like, you can get bonus effects from both platforms if you get like this, like Inazuma 11 Victory Road for multiple platforms. So you can like, kind of stack up the bonus effect rate ups on them. It's very stupid shit. It's the TLDR.
Yeah, yeah, that seems very scummy almost.
I mean, it's scummy in the sense like if you care about those characters, maybe, but you can still obtain them from the other platforms. Like the rate up characters on Xbox, I can still get on Steam, but they just have a more likely chance to show up on Xbox. So it's not necessarily that like they're platform exclusive characters. It's just the rate ups on those characters are exclusive to the platforms, but all of those characters will appear on all the versions of the game, which is what I'm trying to say. I know it's really, really like confusing for people who don't like know that language or that world, but it's just like it's a really dumb bonus thing that people don't have to worry about. The main thing is all these characters will show up. Some of them will have a more increased likely chance to show up when you pull for them on specific platforms, but they are still all in the same. They all still show up regardless of whatever platform you're on. I think the only character that's exclusive is like a pre-order bonus or something. I think.
They're probably going to do a lot of DLC for this, like how they did for Megaton Musashi W Wired, because that was like a paid game and it had the deluxe upgrade. Then they started selling like a shitload of like, I think it was like they have Korone also. They have like cosmetics and they have like some other things. This will probably get quite a bit as well. I feel like Fantasy Life also might get, hopefully that actually ships next month. But yeah, I'm just very happy they're pushing cross save and cross play. Like fully they promoted in the like in the stream as well. Like play with everyone, play on everything.
Yeah.
You have to buy it, obviously, but it's still good to see.
Yeah, I mean level 5, you know, I'm good on them for pushing that and trying to make that the standard across all their games. I really hope that this game works out, because I have no idea how they're going to make their money back on it. I mean, I can't imagine how much they'd have to sell to, like, get even on this game. I don't know. There's so many
I think the last few Inazuma 11 games they did, They had like Nintendo distributed physical releases in Europe on 3DS and DS, I think. And I feel like the 3DS one didn't even get a physical release in North America, because that was like one of the few games I bought digitally on 3DS before I started getting review codes for stuff. So I don't think this was as big in America as it was in Europe, obviously, given like soccer and football or whatever. But I feel like this was one of those things where, you know how like even the Layton games, Nintendo used to distribute the physical releases. So like, we'll see what happens with this digital only title now.
They really need to make a genuine like big push on marketing outside of like these, their marketing efforts of this game, like, and Megaton Musashi 2 were like abysmal.
With Megaton Musashi, what happened is I think they just sent out like review codes to like two or three outlets or people, and then nothing after that, no promotion. And then suddenly, like a month later, they hired another PR company, like a good one, and then they got more coverage at that time. But I feel like the game got discounted pretty quickly because obviously no one knew about it and there were no reviews, so no one was going to buy it. So we'll see what happens with like Fantasy Life and with this. But
well, I mean, the review code situation on Megaton Musashi Wired was fucked, because like the review codes didn't actually count to like 2 weeks after the game already came out, and it's like
no, okay, they did send it to like very few people, like for the actual launch. But yeah, everyone has got it. Like
GameSpot even fucking like requested code, because I know Brendan Hess we requested, they didn't send us code at launch, and it's like, that always blows my mind, because I literally talked with them at TGS. I can't believe that.
It was a bad situation. They need to make sure they have the review code shit settled out for Inazuma 11 if they want coverage on it. And
to mention Fantasy Life coming out next month.
Yeah, and Fantasy Life too. Like, you know, I think that's coming up soon. And I haven't heard anything, but it's wild, and especially for this, the scope of this game. Like, I don't know how you review this game, to be honest, and I don't know what kind of like leeway you would, how much time you would need to actually review this, the scope of this game, because there seems to be so fucking much to this game. I just have no idea. I have no idea at all. I was even joking. I was like, if they want like decent coverage on like for someone to review this like right now in Inazuma 11, like send out review codes like right now, and the person has to like put in like hours daily to fucking cover this game by launch. Which is, I don't know, man. I hope this is the year level 5 sorts out their shit and like kind of, and more people get like know that their games exist and are out and are enjoyable, you know? Like, I always feel like even before current level 5 seems to like always press the let's fuck it up button at like the 11th hour. I always think of Yo-Kai Watch and how bad they fumbled Yo-Kai Watch. They had a $1 billion industry vanished in like a year and a half on them. Like that, like it, Yo-Kai Watch was competitive with Pokemon in a certain era, and they gave it all up. That thing completely vanished off the face of the planet. Like it was nearing on par with Pokemon in Japan at a certain point in time with its popularity. And I cannot believe they just fucking blew it. Not to mention that Yo-Kai Watch 4, which apparently was like excellent, never got an overseas release at all. Let alone like, you know, a port PC, but that's...
Don't need to market it if you don't release it.
Exactly. Level 5, you're so frustrating.
So it turns out we got to just pay someone to play nothing but Inazuma 11 for like 5 months.
That's right. Pay me.
But yeah, check out that new 19-minute long trailer. Watch it in double speed if you have to. But it sounds like it is kind of like Sega's Super Game, only very specific to this one IP coming out of Level 5, who has struggled in the last couple of years. So we'll see where they land in terms of that ambition.
It really feels like a make it or break it type. Like, I really don't want this to fail, because I feel like if this game fails, it's fucking over for Level 5. Because I don't know how much money, time, and resources they invested into the release of this game. It's a little scary.
And with that, we were able to fill out pretty much a normal length podcast with all of the kind of bits and bobs of news and previews and a couple of reviews.
this week, regardless of me saying at the top of the podcast that it was a lull, as we are, you know, our standard to do. But to recap, we have the review for Promise Mascot Agency up on the site. We have Mikhail's kind of comparison of PS5, Switch, Steam Deck, and ROG Ally. AI Limit review from Junior up on the site. We have James's first kind of impressions piece of 7.2, the rating scene, and look out for the more detailed kind of deep dive over on Nova Crystallis in the coming week. Couple announcements with Endless Blue and Neverway. And of course, as we start to detail the summer schedule with upcoming games and trailers, and as we quickly approach that period of the year. You can find RPG Site on all the social media networks. Just search for RPG Space Site on whichever one you want, and we should likely be there. Join our Discord, discord.gg/RPG Site, and go ahead and join that. If you've listened to this podcast, whether on the site or through your podcast service of choice, give us a like, give us a rating. If you've listened all the way to the end like this, we so greatly appreciate it. We know these aren't short, so if you've come to the end, you're a part of an exclusive group, and we really do appreciate you tuning in every week. Next week, we have the Lunar remasters coming out. I assume that'll be kind of the main topic. I forget if other embargoes line up for Clair Obscur or not. Adam, do we know if that's next week or 2 weeks out?
I think that'll be 2 weeks out.
That's what I thought, but you know, you kind of assume release day embargoes, but sometimes you get surprised and there's actually like a 2 week embargo preview, like the olden days. So next week, Lunar, the week after Clair Obscur, and then of course there's other releases in the meantime, like Mandragora and things, other releases that we'll probably get a chance to touch in on, hopefully. But without further ado, thank you so much for listening. Until you hear from us next time, stay safe, take care. We'll talk to y'all later.
Don't fuck it up, level 5, please.